So this is the second recording, finishing the book, beginning on page 153 of John Michael Greer's Collapse Now and Avoid the Rush, the best of the Archdruid Report. The Upside of Default, originally published 25 July 2012. Writing the Archdruid Report has its pleasures, and one of them is the wry amusement to be had when some caustic jab of mine turns into an accurate prediction of the future. Long-time readers may recall a comment of mine last year to the effect that ordinary investors would surely find some way to pile into the shale gas bubble before next year was out. Thanks to an anonymous reader and the August 2012 edition of Smart Money magazine, which arrived from said reader in yesterday's mail, that comment can now be moved over into the confirmed category. Ooh. The prediction, to be sure, didn't require any particular clairvoyance on my part. Its sources are, first, a decent grasp of the history of economic stupidity, and second, a keen sense of the levels of desperation in which we might well call the investmentariat. It's not proletariat, but the investmentariat. The people who have a little money and are looking for a safe place to put it. The investmentariat has been told for decades that their money ought to make them money, but nobody told them that this is only works in an economy that experiences sustained real growth over the long term, and nobody would dream of mentioning in their hearing that we don't have an economy like that anymore. All the investmentariat knows, for sure, is that the kind of safe investment that used to bring in 5% a year is now yielding a small fraction of 1%. And the risks you need to take to get 5% a year are the ones associated with the kind of quote-unquote securities that make a mockery of that title. The resulting panic is smart money's bread and butter. Smart money in the old sense, that is to say, the people who know what's going on in the sword and scam-ridden world of investment, wouldn't want 5 seconds on such a magazine, wouldn't waste 5 seconds on such a magazine. They know you can't get any kind of advantage from something that a couple of million people are also reading. No, this is strictly for the investmentariat. The gloomy, the glossy, glib, and superficial as a teen fashion magazine, and just as unerringly aimed at the lowest common denominator of contemporary thought. It will come as no surprise that the cover story on the August 2012 issue of Smart Money is The Return of Fossil Fuels, and it rehashes the latest cliches about vast new gas and oil reserves without adding any of the inconvenient questions that a competent practitioner of the lost art of journalism, should one be wakened from enchanted sleep by the touch of a 1940s radio microphone, would ask as a matter of course. The article trumpets the fact that America is importing less oil than last year, for example, without mentioning that this is because Americans are using less oil. Unemployed people who've exhausted their 99 weeks of benefits don't take many Sunday drives, and it babbles about natural gas for two largely fact-free pages without mentioning the claims about vast supplies far into the future rely on assumptions about the production decline rate from fracked shale gas wells that make professionals in the gas drilling industry snort beer out of their noses. All of this inevitably is window dressing for the suggestion about which stocks you should buy so that you can cash in on the fracking boom. Last I heard, it was still illegal for journalists to take payroll for pimping individual companies. So to speculate in stocks they promote, still, I trust my readers will already have realized that one set of professional market players will get copies of the magazine in the moment it hits the newsstand, snap up shares in the companies promoted in each issue, and dole them out at inflated prices to smart money readers who get their magazines later. While another set of professional market players will take out short contracts on those same stocks as they peak, wait for the rush of buyers to crest and recede, and cash in on their inevitable losses. Those are among the ways the game is played, and if this suggests to you, dear reader, that the readers of Smart Money are not going to get rich from shale gas by following this month's tips, well, yes, that's what it means. This is business as usual in the financial industry, which has made a lucrative business out of extracting wealth from the investmentariat in various ways. This is part and parcel of the broader and even more lucrative business of extracting wealth from everywhere by every available means. The question that might be worth asking here, and is rarely asked anywhere, is whether the financial industry provides anything to the rest of the economy commensurate with the immense income, with its immense income and profits. Any economics textbook will tell you that companies raise capital by issuing stock, selling bonds, and engaging in a few other kinds of transactions in financial markets, and that this plays a central role in enabling economic growth. Well and good. There are many other ways to do the same thing, but we'll accept that this is the way modern industrial economy societies allot capital to new and expanding businesses. How much of the financial industry's total paper value has anything to do with this service? Let's do some back-of-the-envelope calculations. In 2010, the latest year for which I could find figures, the total value of bonds issued by non-financial businesses was $1.3 trillion, and the total net issuance of stock by all companies was $387 billion. That includes stock issued by financial businesses. But since this is a rough estimate, we'll let that pass. Total stock and bond issuance in 2010 to support the production of real goods and services was thus something less than $1.7 trillion. Let's double that figure just to leave adequate room for other ways of raising capital that might otherwise slip through the cracks. For a very rough order of magnitude figure, around $3.4 trillion. In 2010, the total stock of debt and equity potential available for trading in financial markets was $212 trillion. And the total notional value of derivatives was that same year was estimated at $707 trillion. Exactly how much of this was traded in the course of the year on all markets is anybody's guess. Some stocks heavily traded by computer programs may change hands dozens of times in a day, while other assets spend the whole year sitting in a safe deposit box. Still, this is back-of-the-envelope stuff, so we'll use the total value just listed as a very rough measure of the size of the financial economy. We can round up a little here, too, to make room for forms of wealth not included in the two categories just named, and estimate the total paper value of world's financial wealth at $1 quadrillion, of which the fraction directed into the productive economy in 1 year amounts to around a third of 1%. Now, of course, providing capital to the productive economy is one of the things that the financial industry does that's arguably useful to someone other than financiers. Local and national governments use the financial industry to raise funds for public works. Individuals borrow money for the occasional useful purpose, and so on. Let's be generous and assume that the amount of money that flows from the world of finance for these purposes is double the total input of capital into non-financial businesses via stocks and bonds. That means that in any given year, perhaps 1% of the financial economy has anything to do with the production of real, non-financial goods and services. The rest? It consists of ways to make money from money. That seems innocuous enough until you remember what money actually is. Money is not wealth. It's a system of abstract, culturally conceived tokens that we use to manage the distribution of real goods and services. A money system can simplify the process by putting energy, raw materials, labor, and other goods and services to work in productive ways. That's the reason we have money, or rather, the reason most of us are prepared to discuss in public. That's not what the other 99% of the world's financial assets are doing, though. They are there to ensure that the people who own them have disproportionate unearned access to real non-financial goods and services. That's the other reason, the one nobody wants to mention.
Wow.
Not that many centuries ago, across the world, usury, lending money at interest, was considered a serious crime, more serious than robbery, and was also classed as a mortal sin by Christian and Muslim religious authorities.
Wow.
It's no accident that Dante consigned usurers to the lowest pit of the seventh circle of hell. That's been dismissed as a bit of primitive moralizing by modern writers, but that dismissal is yet another example of the way that contemporary industrial culture has ignored the painfully learned lessons of the past. In a steady state or contracting economy, usury is a parasite that kills its host, since the total stock of real wealth does not expand from one year to the next. Each interest payment ensures that the enriches the lender but leaves the borrower permanently poorer. Only in an expanding economy can usury be tolerated, since interest can be paid out of the proceeds of economic growth. Periods of sustained economic contraction are rare in human history, since most societies live close to the edge of the limits to growth in their bioregions. The exceptions, such as the late Roman Republic and early Empire, usually involve the expansion of one society at the expense of others. The late Roman Republic and early Empire, it may be worth noting, had a large and very successful money-lending industry, which fed on the expanding Roman state in much the same way that the Roman state fed on the accumulated wealth of the Mediterranean world. Only after Roman expansion stopped did attitudes shift in favor of a religion that was violently opposed to usury. During the three centuries of their power, the world's industrial nations looted their non-industrial neighbors with as much enthusiasm as the ancient Romans looted theirs. See, this has got to be the revival of Christianity, the revival of this kind of stuff.
Right, you bet.
If Christianity is going to have any future.
Yes.
But they had another source of plunder. 500 million years of fossil sunlight stored up in the form of coal, oil, and natural gas. In effect, we stripped prehistory to the bare walls so that we could enjoy an age of gargantuan excess unlike any other. One consequence was that our money-lending industry was able to metastasize to a scale no previous gang of usurers had ever been able to attain. The basic arithmetic remains unchanged, though. Usury is only viable in an expanding economy, and as the global economy enters its post-peak oil decline, the entire structure of money that makes money is going to come apart at the seams.
Wow. Remember when we told the guy who was advising church divestment?
Yes.
He said, well, why do I advise them to put the money they're divesting from fossil fuels into? And I said, there is no investment in a contract.
You invest in community.
Yeah, in a contracting economy.
Right.
Yeah.
I like to suggest, in fact, that the unspoken subtext behind the financial crises of recent years is precisely that the real economy of goods and services is no longer growing enough to support the immense financial economy that parasitizes it. The current crisis in Europe is a case in point. Mm-hmm. Since the crisis dawned in 2008, EU policy has demanded that every other sector of the economy be thrown under the bus in order to prop up the tottering mass of unpayable debt that Europe's financial economy has become. As banks fail, governments have been strong-armed into guaranteeing the value of the bank's worthless financial paper. As governments fail, in turn, other governments that are still solvent are being pressured to fill the gap with bailouts that, again, amount to little more than a guarantee that even the most harebrained investment will not be allowed to lose money. The problem, as the back-of-the-envelope calculations above might suggest, is that you can cash in the whole planet's gross domestic product, that was a little under $62 trillion in 2010, and not come anywhere close to the value of the mountain of increasingly fictive paper wealth that's been piled up by the financial industry in the last few decades. Thus, the EU's strategy is guaranteed to fail. EU officials are already talking about quote-unquote haircuts for bondholders. That's financial jargon for investments not getting paid as much as their holdings are theoretically worth. not so long ago that possibility was unmentionable. Now it's being embraced frantically as the only alternative to what's actually going to happen, which is default.
Right, because for companies, normally, you lose all your equity first, and the bondholders are the ones that walk off with the rest. And it got so bad, even the bondholders can't be paid off.
Right. There's been a lot of talk about that in the blogosphere of late, and for good reason. No matter how you twist and turn the matter, Greece is never going to be able to pay its national debt. Neither are Spain, Italy, or half a dozen other nations that ran up big debts when it was cheap and convenient to do so, and are now being strangled by a panicked bond market and a collapsing economy. This isn't new. Most of the countries on Earth have either defaulted outright on their debts or forced renegotiations on their creditors that left the latter with some equivalent of pennies on the dollar. The U.S. last did that in a big way in 1934 when the Roosevelt administration unilaterally changed the terms on billions of dollars in Liberty bonds from payable in gold to payable in devalued dollars and proceeded to print the latter as needed. That, or considerably worse, will be happening in Europe in the near future, too. A good deal of the discussion of these approaching these upcoming defaults in the blogosphere, though, has insisted that these defaults will lead to a complete collapse of the world's financial economy, and from there to an equally complete collapse of the world's productive economy, leaving all 7 billion of us to starve in the gutter. It's an odd belief, since sovereign debt defaults have happened many times in the recent past, currency collapses are far from rare in economic history, and nation-states can do and have done plenty of drastic things in order to keep goods and services flowing in an economic emergency. Partly, I suspect, it's our old friend the apocalypse meme. The notion pervasive in modern culture that the only alternative to indefinite continuation of business as usual is some unparalleled cataclysm or other. Still, there's another dimension to these fantasies, which is simply that the financial industry has done a superb job of convincing people that what they do is important to the rest of us. It's true, to be sure, that having a currency in circulation makes economic exchanges easier, and the kind of banking services that people and ordinary businesses are also very helpful. But governments used to produce and circulate currency without benefit of banks until very fairly recently, and banking services of the kind I've just mentioned can be provided quickly and easily by a government that means business. In 1933, it took the U.S. government just over a week, at the time when information technology was incomparably slower than it is today, to nationalize every bank in the country and open their doors under federal management.
Wow.
The other services in financial industry provides to the real economy can equally be replaced by hastily clugged substitutes, or simply put on hold for duration of the crisis. So the downside of any financial crisis, however grandiose, can be stopped promptly by proven methods. Then there's the upside. Yes, there is an upside. That's the ultimate secret of the financial crisis, the thing that nobody here anywhere wants to talk about. If a country gets into credit crisis, defaulting on its debts is the one option that consistently leads to recovery. That statement ought to be old hat by now. Russia defaulted on its debts in 1998, and that default marked the end of its post-Soviet economic crisis and the beginning of its current period of relative prosperity. Argentina defaulted on its debts in 2002, and the default put an end to its deep recession and set it on the road to recovery. Even more to the point, Iceland was the one European country that refused the EU's demand that debts of failed banks must be passed on to governments. Instead, in 2008, the Icelandic government allowed the country's three biggest banks to fold, paid off Icelandic depositors by way of existing deposit insurance scheme, and left foreign investors twisting in the wind. Since that time, Iceland has been the only European country to see a sustained recovery. When Greece defaults on its debts and leaves the euro in turn, there will be a bit of scrambling, and then the Greek recovery will begin. That's the reason the EU has been trying so frantically to keep Greece from defaulting. No matter how many euros have to be shoveled down, how many rat holes to prevent it. Once,
boy, and this was written
in 2012.
18 months before we are now.
Right.
And just 2 weeks ago, another round
exactly.
of that went. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Once the Greek default happens, and it will, the number of rat holes is multiplying much faster than euros can be shoveled into them. The other southern European nations that are crushed by excessive debt will line up to do the same. There will be a massive stock market crash, a great many banks will go broke, a lot of rich people and even a larger number of middle-class people will lose a great deal of money, politicians will make an assortment of stern and defiant speeches, and then the great European financial crisis will be over and people can get on with their lives. That's what will happen, too, another 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road, when the United States either defaults on its national debt or hyperinflation, or hyperinflates the debt out of existence. It's going to do one or the other, since the debts are already unpayable except by way of the printing press, and its gridlocked political system is unable either to nationalize its tax system or cut its expenditures. The question is simply, what crisis will finally break the confidence of foreign investors in the dollar as a safe haven currency and start the panic selling of dollar-denominated assets that will tip the U.S. into its next really spectacular financial crisis? That's going to be a messy one, since the financial economy is so deeply woven into the fantasy life of the average American, there will be lots of poverty and suffering, as there always is during financial crises. But as John Kenneth Galbraith pointed out about an earlier crisis of the same kind, quote, while it is a time of great tragedy, nothing is being lost but money, unquote. Mm. It will be after that in turn, it will be after that in turn that the next round of temporary recovery can begin. We'll talk more about that in the weeks to come.
Wow. Well, you know what I learned from this one? The whole thing about usury is that, you know, it makes sense in a growing economy and for things such as when we didn't have the cash to buy a van, where we could get a car loan at a reasonable rate.
Like 3%
interest. And our business was expanding.
Right.
Our business was expanding at that point that then allowed us to even accelerate the payment and pay off in 5 years instead of 7.
Correct.
And that made sense.
Right.
And so there's a place for it, both individually, if you are in if getting that money on loan is going to allow you to do something in your personal finances that you couldn't otherwise do.
Right.
But in a contracting economy or a contracting or stable individual situation, it doesn't make sense. And so that's why the worst of the worst of the worst is what happened right prior to 1929. And that's where banks were lending to ordinary Americans money, not for cars, not for houses, but for the Americans to invest in the stock market.
Right.
Can you imagine? I don't know to what extent that's happened now, but that's what the housing bubble was.
No. Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, people building these McMansions out in the middle of nowhere.
Expecting to flip them.
And expecting to flip them, right?
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. The beginning of the world. Originally published 26 December 2012. Last Friday was, as I'm sure most of my readers noticed, an ordinary day. Here in the north central Appalachians, it was chilly, but not unusually so, with high gray clouds overhead and a lively wind setting the dead leaves a swirl. Wrens and sparrows hopped here and there in my garden, poking among the recently turned soil of the beds. No cataclysmic earth changes, alien landings, returning messiahs, or vast heaps of consciousness disturbed their foraging. They neither knew nor cared that one of the great apocalyptic delusions of modern times was reaching its inevitable end around them. The inimitable Dr. Rita Louise, on whose radio talk show I spent a couple of hours on Friday, may have summed it up best when she wished her listeners a happy Mayan Fool's Day. Mm. Not that the ancient Mayans themselves were fools, far from it, but they had had precisely nothing to do with the competing fantasies of doom and universal enlightenment that spent the last decade and more buzzing like flies around last Friday's date. It's worth taking a look back over the genesis of the 2012 hysteria, if only because we're certain to see plenty of reruns in the years ahead. In the first half of the 20th century, as archaeologists learned to read dates in the Mayan long count calendar, it became clear that one of the major cycles of the old Mayan timekeeping system would roll over on that day. By the 1970s, that detail found its way into alternative culture in the United States, setting off the first tentative speculations about a 2012 apocalypse. Notably, drug guru Terence McKenna's quirky Time Wave Zero theory. It was the late New Age promoter Jose Arguelles, though, who launched the 2012 fad on its way with his 1984 book, The Mayan Factor, and a series of sequels proclaiming that the rollover of the Mayan calendar in 2012 marked the imminent transformation of human consciousness that the New Age movement was predicting so enthusiastically back then. The exactness of the date made an intriguing contrast with the vagueness of Arguelles' predictions about it. And this contrast left ample room for other authors in the same field to jump on the bandwagon and redefine the prophecy to fit whatever way, whatever their own eschatological preferences happened to be. This they promptly did. Early on, 2012 faced plenty of competition from alternative dates for the Great Transformation. The year 2000 had been a great favorite for a century, and became 2012's most important rival, but it came and went without bringing anything more interesting than another round of sordid business as usual. Thereafter, 2012 reigned supreme and became the center of a frenzy of anticipation that was at least as much about marketing as anything else. I can testify from my own experience that for a while there, late in the last decade, if you wanted to write a book about anything even vaguely tangential to New Age subjects and couldn't give it a 2012 spin, many publishers simply weren't interested. So the predictions piled up, and the fact that no two of them predicted the same thing did nothing to weaken the mass appeal of the date. Neither did the fact, which became increasingly clear as the last months of 2012 approached, that a great many people who talked endlessly about the wonderful or terrible things that were about to happen weren't acting as though they believed a word of it. That was, by and large, as true of the New Age writers as pundits who fed the hysteria as it was of their readers and audiences. I long ago lost track of the number of 2012 prophets who, aside from scheduling a holiday trip in the Yucatan to the Yucatan or some other fashionable spot for the big day, acted in all respects as though they expected the world to keep going and in its current manner straight into 2013 and beyond. That came as a surprise to me. Regular readers will recall my earlier speculation that 2012 would see scenes reminiscent of the Great Disappointment of 1844, with crowds of true believers standing atop hilltops waiting for their first glimpse of alien spacecraft descending from the heaven, or what have you. Instead, in the last months of this year, some of the writers and pundits most deeply involved with the 2012 hysteria started claiming that, well, actually, December 21st, wasn't going to be the day everything changed. It would, usher in a period of transformation of undefined length, during which everything would sooner or later get around to changing. Mm. That was sort of Barbara Marx Hubbard's approach. The closer last Friday came, the more evasive the predictions became, and Mayan's Fool's Day and its aftermath were notable for the near total silence that spread across the apocalyptic end of the blogosphere. Say what you will about Harold Camping, at least he had the courage to go on the air after his May prophecy flopped and admit that he must have gotten his math wrong somewhere. Now, of course, Camping went on at once to propose a new date for the rapture, which flopped with equal inevitability a few months later. It's a foregone conclusion that some of the 2012 prophets will do the same thing shortly, if only to kick the apocalyptic marketing machine back into gear. It's entirely possible that they'll succeed in setting off a new frenzy for some other date, because the social forces that make apocalyptic fantasies so tempting to believe just now have not lost any of their potency. The most important of these forces, as I've argued in previous posts, is the widening mismatch between the fantasy of entitlement that has metastasized throughout contemporary American society, on the one hand, and the ending of an age of fossil-fueled imperial extravagance, on the other. As the United States goes bankrupt trying to maintain its global empire, and its industrial civilization as a whole sizzles down the far side of a dizzying range of depleted curves, it's becoming harder by the day for Americans to make believe that the old saws of upward mobility and an even brighter future have any relevance to their own lives. And yet those beliefs are central to the psychology, the self-image, and the worldview of most Americans. The resulting cognitive dissonance is hard to bear, and apocalyptic fantasies offer a convenient way out. They promise that the world will change, and so the believers don't have to. Mm. That same frantic desire to ignore the arrival of inescapable change pervades today's cultural scene, even in those subcultures that insist most loudly that change is what they want. In recent months, to cite only one example, nearly every person who's mentioned to me the claim that climate change could make the Earth uninhabitable has gone on to ask, often in so many words, so why should I consume less now? The overt logic here is usually that individual action can't possibly be enough. Whether or not that's true is anyone's guess, but cutting your own carbon footprint actually does something, which is more than can be said for sitting around enjoying a standard industrial world lifestyle while waiting for the imaginary kumbaya moment when everybody else in the world will embrace limits not even the most ardent climate activists are willing to accept themselves. Another example? Consider the rhetoric of elite privilege that clusters around the otherwise inoffensive label 1%. That rhetoric plays plenty of roles in today's society. One of them pops up reliably anytime I talk about using less. Why, people ask me in angry tones, should they give up their cars when the absurdly rich are enjoying gigantic luxury yachts? Now, of course, we could have the conversation about the total contribution to global warming of cars owned by people who aren't rich compared to that of the fairly small number of top-end luxury lots that usually figure in such arguments. But there's another point that needs to be raised. None of the people who make this argument to me have any control over whether rich people have luxury yachts. All of them have a great deal of control over whether and how they themselves use cars. Blaming the global ecological crisis on the very rich thus functions in practice as one more way to avoid the necessity of unwelcome change. Wow. Along these same lines, dear reader, as you surf the peak oil and climate change blogosphere and read the various opinions on display there, I'd encourage you to ask yourself what those opinions amount to in actual practice. A remarkably large fraction of them, straight across the political landscape, from farthest left to farthest right, and including all stops in between, add up to demands that somebody else, somewhere else, do something. Since the people making the demands rarely do anything to pressure or even encourage those other people elsewhere to do whatever it is that they're supposed to do, it's not exactly hard to do the math and recognize that here again, these opinions amount to so many ways of insisting that other people holding them don't have to give up, insist that the people holding them don't have to give up the extravagant and unsustainable lifestyles most people in the industrial world think of as normal and justifiable. This is why I have to define true Christian living as living with less energy, less stuff, less stimulation.
Right.
that that's the path of the Christ. That's the path of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Not that God wants you to be rich and extractive and colossal. There's another way to make the same point, which is that most of what you'll see being proposed in the peak oil and climate change blogosphere has been proposed over and over again already, without the least impact on our predicament. From the protest marches and the petitions, through the latest round of grand plans for energy futures destined to sit on the shelves, cheek by jowl with the last round, right up to this week's flurry of buoyantly optimistic blog posts lauding any techno fix you care to name, from cold fusion and algal biodiesel to shale gas and drill baby drill, have been there, done that, used the t-shirt to wipe another dozen endangered species off the face of the planet. And we're still stuck in the same place. The one thing next to nobody wants to talk about is the one thing that distinguished the largely successful environmental movement of the 1960s and 1970s from the largely futile environmental movement since that time, which is that activists in the earlier movement were willing to start the ball rolling by making the necessary changes in their own lives first. The difficulty, of course, is that making those changes is precisely what many of today's green activists are desperately trying to avoid. That's understandable, since transitioning to a lifestyle that's actually sustainable involves giving up many of the comforts, perks, and privileges central to the psychology and identity of people in modern industrial societies. In today's world of accelerating downward mobility, especially, the thought of taking any action that might result in being mistaken for the poor is something most Americans in particular can't bear to contemplate, even when those same Americans recognize on some level that sooner or later, like it or not, they're going to end up poor anyway. Those of my readers who would like to see this last bit of irony focused to incandescence need only to get some comfortable middle-class eco-liberal to start waxing lyrical about life in the sustainable world of the future, when we'll all have to get by on a small fraction of our current resource base. This is rarely difficult. I field such comments quite often, sketching out rose-colored contrast between today's comfortable but unsatisfying lifestyles and the more meaningful and fulfilling existence that will be ours in the future of honest hard work in harmony with nature. Wait until your target is in the full spate, and then point out that he could embrace that more meaningful and fulfilling lifestyle right now by the simple expedient of discarding the comforts and privileges that stand in the way. You'll get to watch backpedaling on a heroic scale, accompanied by a flurry of excuses meant to justify your target's continued dependence on the very comforts and privileges he was belittling a few minutes before. What makes the irony perfect is that, by and large, the people whom you'll hear criticizing the modern lifestyles they themselves aren't willing to renounce aren't just mouthing verbal noises. They realize, many of them, that the lifestyles the industrial societies provide, even to their most privileged inmates, are barren of meaning and value, and the pursuit of consumption of an endless series of increasingly shoddy manufactured products is a very poor substitute for a life well lived, and that stepping outside the narrowing walls of a world defined by the perks of the consumer economy is the first step toward a more meaningful existence. They know this. What they lack, by and large, is the courage to act on that knowledge, and so they wander the beach like J. Alfred Prufrock in Eliot's poem, letting the very last inch or so of the waves splash over their feet, the bottoms of their trousers rolled up carefully, to be sure, to keep them from getting wet, when they know that a running leap into the green and foaming water is the one thing that can save them. Thus, it's not surprising that their daydreams cluster around imaginary tidal waves that will come rolling in from the deep ocean to sweep them away, to make the whole question moot. This is why it's as certain as anything can be that within a year or so, at most, a good many people who spent the last decade or so talking endlessly about last Friday will have come to some other date lined up for the end of the world, and will talk about it just as incessantly. It's that or face up to the fact that the only way to live up to the ideals they think they espouse is to walk straight toward the thing they most fear, which is the loss of the perks and privileges and comforts that define their identity, an identity many of them hate, but still can't imagine doing without. Meanwhile, of course, the economy, the infrastructure, and the resource flows that make those perks and privileges and comforts possible are coming apart around them. There's a great deal of wry amusement to be gained from watching one imaginary cataclysm or another seize the imagination of the peak oil scene or society as a whole. While the thing people think that they're talking about, the collapse of industrial civilization, has been unfolding all around them for several years now, in exactly the way real collapses of real civilizations happen in the real world. Look around you, dear reader, as the economy stumbles through another round of contraction, papered over with increasingly desperate financial gimmicks. The political system of your country moves ever deeper into dysfunction. Jobs and livelihoods go away forever. Whatever social safety net you're used to having comes apart. Towns and neighborhoods devastated by natural disasters are abandoned rather than being rebuilt. And the basic services that once defined a modern society stop being available to a larger and larger fraction of the people of the industrial world. This is what collapse looks like. This is what people in the crumbling Roman Empire and all those other extinct civilizations saw when they looked out the window. To those in the middle of the process, as I've discussed in previous posts, it seems slow, but future generations with the benefit of hindsight will shake their heads in wonder at how fast industrial civilization went to pieces. I commented in a post at the start of this year that the then current round of fast collapse predictions, the same predictions, mind you, that had been retailed at the start of the year before that, and so on, were not only wrong, as of course they turned out to be, but missed the collapse that was already underway. The same point holds good for the identical predictions that will no doubt be retailed over the next few weeks, insisting that this is the year when the stock market will plunge to zero, the dollar and or the euro will lose all its value, the economy will seize up completely and leave the grocery stores bare, and so on endlessly. Or, for that matter, that this is the year when cold fusion or algal biodiesel or some other vaporware technology will save us. Or the climate change kumbaya moment I mentioned earlier will get around to happening or what have you. It's as safe a bet can it's as safe as a bet can be that none of these things will happen in 2013 either. Here again, though, the prophecies in question are not so much wrong as irrelevant. If you're on a sinking ocean liner and the water's rising fast below decks, it's not exactly useful to get into a heated debates with your fellow parishioners about whether the ship is most likely to be vaporized by aliens or eaten by Godzilla. In the same way, it's a bit late to speculate about how industrial civilization will collapse or how to keep it from collapsing when the collapse is already well underway. What matters at this stage in the game is getting some sense of how the process will unfold, not in some abstract sense, but in the uncomfortably specific sense of where you are, with what you have, in the days and weeks and months and the years immediately ahead of you. And after deciding what you are going to do about it. With that in mind, dear reader, I'd like to ask you to do something right now, before going on to the next paragraph after this one. If you're in a temperate or subarctic regions of the northern hemisphere, and you're someplace where you can adjust the temperature up, get up, and go turn the thermostat down 3 degrees, if that makes the place too chilly for your tastes, take another moment or two to put on a sweater. If you're in a different place or in a different situation, do something else simple to decrease the amount of energy you're using at this moment. Go ahead. Do it now. I'll wait for you here. just turned off our heater.
Good.
Have you done it? If so, you've just completed something that all the apocalyptic fantasies, internet debates, and protest marches of the last two decades haven't. You've decreased, by however little, the use of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere. That sweater, or rather the act of putting it on, instead of turning up the heat, has also made you just a little less dependent on fossil fuels. In both cases, to be sure, the change you've made is very small. But a small change is better than no change at all. And a small change that can be repeated, expanded, and turned into a stepping stone on the way to bigger changes is infinitely better than any amount of grand plans and words and hand-waving that never quite managed to accomplish anything in the real world. Turning your thermostat down, it's been said repeatedly, isn't going to save the world. That's quite true, though it's equally true that the actions that have been pursued by climate change and peak oil activists to date don't look particularly likely to save the world either. And let's not even talk about what wasn't accomplished by all the wasted breath over last Friday's non-event. That being the case, even taking even the smallest practical steps in your own life and then proceeding from there will take you a good deal further than waiting for the mass movements that never happen, for the new technologies that never pan out, or for that matter, the next deus ex machina some canny marketer happens to pin onto another arbitrary date in the future as a launching pad for the next round of apocalyptic hysteria. Meanwhile, a world is ending. The promoters of the 2012 industry got that right, though they missed just about everything else. The process has been underway for some years now, and it won't reach its conclusion in our lifetimes. But what we may as well call the modern world is coming to an end around us. The ancient Mayans knew, however, that the end of the world is always the beginning of another. And it's an interesting detail of all the old Mesoamerican cosmological myths that the replacement for the old world doesn't just pop into being. Somebody has to take action to make the world begin. It's a valid point, and one that can be applied to our present situation, when so many people are sitting around waiting for the end, and so few seem to be willing to kickstart the beginning in the only way that matters, that is, by making actual changes in their own lives. The deindustrial world of the future is poised to begin, but someone has to begin it. Shall we?
Wow. That is awesome.
Oh, I love this one. The next 10 billion years.
Oh, yeah.
Originally published the 4th of September, 2013. Earlier this week, I was trying to think of ways to talk about the gap between notions about the future we've been all absorbed from the last 300 years of fossil fuel progress, on the one hand, and the ways of thinking about what's ahead that might actually help us make sense of our predicament and the post-petroleum, post-progress world ahead, on the other. While I was in the middle of these reflections, a correspondent reminded me of a post from last year by peak oil blogger Hugo Bardi, which set out to place the crises of our times in the context of the next 10 billion years. It's an ambitious project, and by no means badly carried out. The only criticism that comes to mind is that it only makes sense if you happen to be a true believer in the civil religion of progress, the faith whose rise and impending fall has been a central theme here in recent months. As a sermon delivered to the faithful of that religion, it's hard to beat. It's even got the classic structure of evangelical rhetoric, the awful fate that will soon fall upon those who won't change their wicked ways, the glorious salvation awaiting those who get right with progress, and all the rest of it. Of course, the implied comparison with Christianity can only be taken so far. Christians are generally expected to humble themselves before their God, while believers in progress like to imagine that humanity will become God, or, as in this case, are able to pat God fondly on the head and say, "That's my kid." More broadly, those of my readers who were paying attention last week will notice that the horrible fate that awaits the sinful is simply that nature will be allowed to go her own way, while the salvation awaiting the righteous is more or less the ability to browbeat nature into doing what they think she ought to do, or rather what Barty's hypothesized new intelligence, whose interests are assumed to be compatible with those of humanity, thinks she ought to do. There's plenty that could be said about biophobia, the stark, shivering dread of life's normal and healthy ripening toward death that pervades this kind of thinking. But that's a subject for another post. Here I'd like to take another path. Once the notions of perpetual progress and imminent apocalypse are seen as industrial society's traditional folk mythologies, rather than meaningful resources for making predictions about the future, and known details about ecology, evolution, and astrophysics are used in their place to fill out the story, the next 10 billion years looks very different from either of Barty's scenarios. Here's my version, or if you will, my vision. 10 years from now. Business as usual continues. The human population peaks at 8.5 billion. Liquid fuel production remains more or less level by the simple expedient of consuming an ever larger fraction of the world's total energy output, and the annual cost of weather-related disasters continues to rise. Politicians and the media insist loudly that better times are just around the corner as times get steadily worse. Among those who recognize that something's wrong, one widely accepted viewpoint holds that fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration will shortly solve all our problems, and therefore we don't have to change the way we live. Another, equally popular, insists that total human extinction is scarcely a decade away, and therefore we don't have to change the way we live. Most people accept one or the other claim, while the last chance for meaningful systemic change slips silently away. 100 years from now. It's been a difficult century. After more than a dozen major wars, 3 bad pandemics, widespread famine, and steep worldwide decline in public health and civil order, human population is down to 3 billion and falling. Sea level is up 4 meters and rising fast as Greenland and West Antarctic ice caps disintegrate. Fossil fuel production grounds to a halt decades earlier as the last economically producible reserves were exhausted, and most proposed alternatives turned out to be unaffordable in the absence of the sort of cheap, abundant, highly concentrated energy only fossil fuels can provide. Cornucopians still insist that fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration will save us any day now, and their opponents still insist that human extinction is imminent, but most people are too busy trying to survive to listen to either group. 1,000 years from now. The Earth is without ice caps and glaciers for the first time in 20 million years or so, and sea level has gone up more than 100 meters worldwide. Much of the world has a tropical climate, as it did 50 million years earlier. Human population is 100 million, up from half that figure at the bottom of the bitter dark age, now passing into memory. Only a few scholars have any idea what the words fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration once meant, and though there are still people insisting that the end of the world will arrive any day now, their arguments now generally rely more overtly on theology than before. New civilizations are rising in various corners of the world, combining legacy technologies with their own unique cultural forms. The one thing they'll all have in common is that the technological society of a millennium before is their ideal of evil incarnate. 10,000 years from now. The rise in global temperature has shut down the thermohaline circulation and launched an oceanic anoxic event. The planet's normal negative feedback process when carbon dioxide levels get out of hand. That's what I was talking about before in terms of the pink sky or whatever. That guy's right. The blue sky. Yeah.
Green sky.
No, green sky. Yeah, there's a book by that title. Today's industrial civilization is a dim memory. from the mostly forgotten past, as far removed from this time as the Neolithic Revolution is from ours. Believers in most traditional religions declare piously that the climate changes of the last 10 millennia are the result of human misbehavior, while rationalists insist that this is all superstition and that the climate changes have perfectly natural causes. As the anoxic oceans draw carbon out of the biosphere and entomb it in the sediments on the seafloor, the climate begins a gradual cooling, a process which helps push humanity's sixth global civilization into its terminal decline. 100,000 years from now. Carbon dioxide levels drop below pre-industrial levels as the ocean anoxic event finishes its work, and the complex feedback loops that govern Earth's climate shifts again. The thermohaline circulation restarts, triggering another round of climatic changes. Humanity's 79th global civilization flourishes and begins its slow decline as the disruptions set in motion by a long-forgotten industrial age are drowned out by an older climatic cycle. The scholars of that civilization are thrilled by the notions of fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration. They have no idea that we were dreaming the same dreams before them, being further in our future than the first Neanderthals are in our past. But they will have no more luck achieving those dreams than we did. 1,000,000 years from now. The Earth is an ice age. Great ice sheets cover most of the northern hemisphere and spread from mountain ranges all over the world, and sea level is 150 meters lower than today. To the people living at this time, who have never known anything else, this seems perfectly normal. Metals have become rare geological specimen for millennia now. Most human societies have used renewable ceramic bioplastic composites instead, and the very existence of fossil fuels has long since been forgotten. The 664th global human civilization is at its peak, lofting aerostat towns into the sky and building great floating cities on the seas. Its long afternoon will eventually draw to an end after scores of generations, and when it falls, other civilizations will take its place. 10,000,000 years from now. The long glacial epoch that began in the Pleistocene has finally ended, and the Earth is returning to its more usual status as a steamy jungle planet. This latest set of changes proves to be just that little bit too much for humanity. No fewer than 8,639 global civilizations have risen and fallen over the last 10 million years, each with its own unique sciences, technology, art, literatures, philosophies, and ways of thinking about the cosmos. The shortest lived lasted for less than a century before blowing itself to smithereens, while the longest lasted endured for 8 millennia before finally winding down. All that is over now. There are still relic populations of human beings in Antarctica and a few island chains, and another 1,000,000 years will pass before cascading climate and ecological changes finally push the last of them over the brink into extinction. Meanwhile, in the tropical forests of what is now southern Siberia, the descendants of raccoons have crossed the Bering Land Bridge during the last Great Ice Age and are proliferating rapidly, expanding into empty ecological niches once filled by the larger primates. In another 30 million years or so, their descendants will come down from the trees. 100 million years from now.
Million?
100 million years from now. He keeps going by a factor of 10.
Well, I thought you said...
The last one was 10 million.
I thought you said 10 billion.
No. It's gone from 10 years. It's gone 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years, 1,000,000 years, 10 million years, and now this one is 100 million years from now.
Okay.
Retro rockets fire and fall silently as the ungainly craft settles down on the surface of the moon.
Oh boy.
After feverish final checks, the hatch is opened, and two figures descend onto the lunar surface. They are bipeds, but not even remotely human. Instead, they belong to Earth's third intelligent species. They are distantly descended from the crows of our time, though they look no more like crows than you and I look like tree shrews in the middle of the Cretaceous. Since you have a larynx rather than a strynx, you can't even begin to pronounce what they call themselves, so we'll call them corvins. Earth's second intelligent species, whom we'll call scions, C-Y-O-N-S.
Or procyonidae is the raccoon.
Raccoon procyonidae, right. Mm-hmm. After their raccoon ancestors are long gone. They lasted a little longer than 8 million years before the changes in an unstable planet sent them down the long road to extinction. They never got that deeply into technology, though their political institutions made the most sophisticated human equivalents look embarrassingly crude. The corvins are another matter, since some twist of inherited psychology left them with a passion for heights and upward movement. They worked out the basic principles of the hot air balloon before they got around to inventing the wheel, and balloons, gliders, and corvin-carrying kites played much the same roles in their earliest epic literature that horses and chariots play in ours. As corvin societies evolved more complex technologies, eyes gazing upward from soaring tower cities at the moon, the perch of perches set high above the world. All that was needed to make those dreams a reality was petroleum, and 100 million years or more is more than enough time for Earth to restock her petroleum reserves, especially if that period starts off with an oceanic and anoxic event that stashes gigatons of carbon in marine sediments. Thus, it was inevitable that sooner or later, the strongest of the great corvin kilth assemblies would devote its talents and wealth to the task of reaching the moon. The universe has a surprise in store for the corvins, though. Their first moon landing included among its goals the investigation of some odd surface features, too small to be seen clearly by Earth-based equipment. That first lander thus set down on a flat lunar plain that a very long time ago, was called the Sea of Tranquility. And so it was that the stunned corvin astronauts found themselves facing the fragmentary but unmistakable remains of a spacecraft that arrived on the moon in the unimaginably distant past. A few equivocal traces buried in terrestrial sediments had suggested already to corvin lore masters that another intelligent species might have lived on the Earth before them, though the theory was dismissed by most as wild speculation. The shattered remnants of the moon confirmed them and made it hard for even the most optimistic corvins to embrace the notion that some providence guaranteed the survival of intelligent species. The curious markings of some of the remains, which some lore masters suggested might be a mode of visual communication, resisted all attempts at decipherment, and very little was ever learnt for certain about the enigmatic ancient species that left its mark on the moon. Even so, it will be suggested long afterwards that the stark warning embodied in those long-abandoned spacecraft played an important role in convincing corvin societies to rein in the extravagant use of petroleum and other non-renewable resources, though it also inspired hugely expensive and ultimately futile attempts to achieve interstellar migration. For some reason, the corvins never got into the quest for fusion power or artificial intelligence. One way or another, though, the corvins turned out to be the most enduring of Earth's intelligent species, and more than 28 million years passed before their day finally ended. Mm. 1 billion years from now. The Earth is old and mostly desert, and its significant fraction of its total crust is made up of the remains of bygone civilizations. As increasing heat of the sun as it proceeds through its own life cycle, and the ongoing loss of volatile molecules from the upper atmosphere into space, have reduced the seas to scattered salty basins amid great sandy wastes. Only near the north and south poles does vegetation flourish, and with it the corbicles, Earth's 11th and last intelligent species. Their ancestors in our time are an invasive species of freshwater clam. Don't, and he has in parentheses, don't laugh. A billion years ago, your ancestors were still trying to work out the details of multicellularity.
Whoa.
The corbicles have the same highly practical limb structure as the rest of their subphylum. The six stumpy podicles for walking, two muscular dorsal tentacles for gross manipulation, and two slender buccal tentacles by mouth for fine manipulations. They spend most of their time in sprawling underground city complexes, venturing to the surface to harvest vegetation to feed the subterranean metafungal gardens that provide them with nourishment. By some combination of luck and a broad general tendency towards cephalization common to many evolutionary lineages, Earth's last intelligent species is also its most intellectually gifted. Hatchlings barely out of the creche are given fun little logic problems such as Fermi's last theorem for their amusement. And a huge majority of adult corbicles are involved in one or another field of an intellectual endeavor. Being patient, long-lived, and not greatly addicted to collective stupidities, they have gone very far indeed. Some 8,000 years back, a circle of young radical corpical thinkers proposed the project of working out all the physical laws of the cosmos, starting from first principles. So unprecedented a suggestion sparked countless debates, politicians, ceremonial publications, ceremonial dances, and professional duels in which elderly scholars killed themselves in order to cast unbearable opprobrium on their rivals. Still, it was far too delectable an intellectual challenge to be left unanswered, and the work has proceeded ever since. In the course of their researches, without placing any great importance on the fact, the best minds among the corbicles have proved conclusively that nuclear fusion, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration were never practical options in the first place. Being patient, long-lived, and not greatly addicted to collective stupidities, the corbicles have long since understood and accepted their eventual fate. In another 6 million years, as the sun expands and the Earth's surface temperature rises, the last surface vegetation will perish and the corbicles will go extinct. In another 90 million years, the last multicellular life forms will die out. In another 200 million years, the last seas will boil, and Earth's biosphere, nearing the end of its long, long life, will nestle down into the deepest crevices of its ancient, rocky world and drift into final sleep. 10 billion years from now. Earth is gone. It had a splendid funeral. Its body plunged into stellar fire as the sun reached its red giant stage and expanded out to the orbit of Mars, and its ashes were flung outward into interstellar space with the first great helium flash that marked the beginning of the sun's descent toward its destiny. 2 billion years later, the gas and dust-rich shockwave from that flash plowed into a mass of interstellar dust dozens of light-years away from the sun's pale corpse and kick-started one of the great transformative processes of the cosmos. Billions more years have passed since that collision. A yellow-orange K2 star now burns cheerily in the midst of 6 planets and 2 asteroid belts. The second planet has a surface temperature between the freezing and boiling points of water, and a sufficiently rich assortment of elements to set another of the great transformative processes of the cosmos into motion. Now in one spot of the surface of this world, rising up past bulbous, purplish things that don't look anything like trees but fill the same broad ecological function, there is a crag of black rock. On top of that crag, a creature sits, looking at the stars, fanning its lunicles with its sagittal crest and waving its pedipolyps meditatively back and forth. It's one of the first members of the world's first intelligent species, and it is, for the first time ever on that world, considering the stars and wondering if other beings might live out there among them. The creature's biochemistry, structure, and life cycle have nothing in common with yours, dear reader. Its world, its sensory organs, its mind and its feelings would be utterly alien to you, even if 10 billion years didn't separate you. Nonetheless, it so happens that a few atoms that are currently part of your brain as you read these words will also be part of the brain analog of that creature on the crag of that distant, not yet existing world. Does that fact horrify you, intrigue you, console you, leave you cold? It's worth reflecting on that choice, and even more worth reflecting on its implications.
Well, I tell you, I reflect on those globular tree-like purple things. That's my sense of accomplishment. Wow. Not the next intelligence. So trees can continue.
The trees, right? Can... Oh, my God, this guy's an international treasure.
That was awesome. I remember that essay, but not in that detail.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, you know, and to have people read Ugo Bardi's 10 billion years, which is the eco, you know, which is the techno-optimistic vision, and have people read this and just realize that both are possible visions. Which one do you think is more realistic?
Right.
You know, which one do you think is more grounded in primary reality?
Right, but the techno vision has to be not pie in the sky with no concern.
Right, exactly. The techno vision has to include that technology has helped us live in right relationship to the air, water, soil, and life.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Ecology.
Yes, that's why and ecology is the new theology.
Techno-optimists
yes.
are fine to have do their thing and concentrate on what they do so long as they accept that.
Yes.
And that there is a sense that we've been out of right relationship with the primary economy.
Well, primary economy of nature, right.
Nature.
Right.
And that none of the techno can possibly come into being without the basic quiet support of what we all have taken for granted.
Absolutely.
For too many centuries.
Yep.
And which our ancestors, however ancient they may be, never did.
Yeah.
They had the humility, necessity of humility.
Right. Yeah, that may be the fundamental stance toward primary reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. All the different religious traditions, when you look at just the postures of the human animal, the posture of kneeling, the posture of praying, the posture of palms open, the postures of hands outstretched, this is a posture of humility toward that which is greater than you.
Right.
That which is your primary source, your reality, your sustenance, your end.
Mm-hmm. Well, the beauty of what Greer was doing with that last part is, well, no, you got to start
with the atoms.
You got to start off with the Polking horn.
Oh, right. This does the opposite of, for me at least, the opposite of John Polkinghorne's fear that in, you know, 20 some odd trillion years or whatever, the universe achieves heat death. Therefore, nothing is meaningful if you don't posit an otherworldly God.
Yeah, and so what that occurred to me was that. In that final sequence.
The final sentence almost, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. With that creature in some other solar system somewhere with a newborn star. You can have the opportunity, if you wish, to think that there's a couple atoms in your brain right now that will end up in the brain of that
right.
pedipalp
whatever
creature thing there. And... And that's the opportunity to either, so it works either way. If you need to have for your sense of meaning that the species life cycle of the human or the planet life cycle of earthlings, which culminates in that molluscan type thing, if you really, really need to have your sense of meaning dependent on that carrying forward, well, here he's throwing you a bone. You say, well, you know, a couple atoms in your brain right now yeah. could be on that other, you know, new solar system out there. Or he's giving you the opportunity to set that whole thing of immortality aside and find meaning in a temporal expression that does not require immortality to be a piece of it.
And yet it's all about continuation, continuity or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Well, cyclical continuity.
Yeah.
Cyclical.
Right. Man, conqueror of nature, dead at 408. Originally published the 4th of December, 2013. Man, the conqueror of nature, died Monday night of a petroleum overdose. Ooh. The medical examiner's office confirmed this morning. The abstract representation of the human race was 408 years old. The official announcement had done nothing to quell the rumors of suicide and substance abuse that have swirled around the death scene since the first announcement yesterday morning, adding new legal wrinkles in the struggle already underway over man's inheritance. Man's closest associates disagree about what happened. His longtime friend and confidant, technology, thinks it was suicide. Sure, man liked to have a good time, he said at a press conference Tuesday evenings. He was a pretty heavy user. But it wasn't like he was out of control or anything. No, I'm sure he did it on purpose. Just a couple of weeks ago, we were hanging out at his place, looking up at the moon and talking about the trips we made out there. And he turned to me and said, "You know, Tech, that was a good time, a really good time. I wonder if I'll ever do anything like that again." He got into moods like that more and more often in the last few years. I tried to cheer him up, talking about going to Mars or what have you, and he'd go along with it, but you could tell his heart wasn't in it. Other witnesses told a different story. "It was terrifying," said a housekeeper who requested that her name not be given. "He was using more and more of this stuff every day, shooting it up in the morning, noon, and night. And when his connections couldn't get him as much as he wanted, he'd go nuts. You'd hear him screaming at the top of his lungs and pounding his fists on the wall. Everybody on the staff would hide whenever that happened, and it happened more and more often. The amount he was using was just unbelievable. Some of his friends tried talking him into getting help, or even just cutting back a little on his petroleum habit, but he wouldn't listen. The medical examiner's office and the police are investigating man's death right now. Until their report comes out, the tragic end of humanity's late self-image remains shrouded in mystery and speculation. A tumultuous family saga." "He was always a rebel," said Cleo, the muse of history, in an exclusive interview in her office on Mount Helicon this morning. "That was partly his early environment, of course. He was born in the household of Sir Francis Bacon, remember, and brought up by some of the best minds of 17th century Europe. An abstract image of humanity raised by people like that wasn't likely to sit back and leave things as they were. Still, I think there were strong family influences, too. His father was quite the original figure himself back in the day. Though almost forgotten nowadays, man's father, Everyman, the abstract representation of medieval humanity, was as mediagenic in his own time as his son became later on. The star of a widely popular morality play, with its subject of countless biographies, Everyman was born in extreme poverty in a hovel in post-Roman Europe, worked his way up to become a wealthy and influential figure in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, then stepped aside from his financial and political affairs to devote his last years to religious concerns. Savage quarrels between father and son kept the broadsheet and pamphlet press fed with juicy stories all through the 17th and 18th centuries, and eventually led to their final breach over Darwin's theory of evolution in 1859. By that time, man was already having problems with substance abuse. He was just using coal at first, technology reminisced. Well, let's be fair, we both were. There was that hot new drug. That was the hot new drug in those days. It was cheap, you could get it without too much hassle, and everybody on the cutting edge was using it. I remember one trip we took together. It was one of those early railroads at 30 miles an hour. We thought that was really fast. We were innocent back then. Were we innocent back then or what? Cleo agreed with that assessment. I don't think man had any idea what he was getting into when he started abusing coal, she said. It was an easy habit to fall into, very popular in avant-garde circles just then, and nobody yet knew much about the long-term consequences of fossil fuel abuse. Then, of course, he started his campaign to conquer nature, and he found out very quickly that he couldn't keep up the pace he'd set for himself without artificial help. That was when the real tragedy began. The conquest of nature. It's an open question when man first decided to conquer nature. The biographers all have their own opinions on that, Cleo exclaimed, gesturing at a shelf loaded with books on man's dramatic and controversial career. Some trace it back to the influence of his foster father, Francis Bacon, or the other mentors and teachers he had in his early days. Others say that the inspiration came from the crowd he ran with when he was coming of age in the 18th and 19th centuries. He used to tell interviewers that it was a family thing, that everyone in his family all the way back to the Stone Age had been trying to conquer nature, and he was just the one who finally succeeded. But that won't stand up to any kind of scrutiny. Examine the career of every man, for example, and you'll find that he wasn't interested in conquering nature. He wanted to conquer himself. The business about conquering nature, technology said, he got into that back when we were running around being young and crazy. I think he got the idea originally from his foster father or one of the other old guys who taught him when he was a kid. But as far as I know, it wasn't a big deal to him until later. Now, I could be wrong, you know. I didn't know him that well in those days. I was mostly just doing my own thing, digging mines, building water mills, and stuff like that. We didn't really get close until we both got involved in the complicated coal deal. We were in this complicated coal deal. We were both using, but I was dealing too, and I could get it cheaper than anybody else. I was using steam, and some of the other dealers knew, and none of the other dealers knew how to do that. So we'd got to be friends, and we'd had some really wild times together. And now and then, when we were really good and ripped, he'd get to talking about how nature ought to belong to him, and one of these days he was going to hire some soldiers and just take it. Me, I couldn't have cared less, except that man kept on bringing me these great technological problems, really sweet little puzzles, and I've always been a sucker for those. He'd figured out that how I was going to get coal for him so cheap, you see, and guessed that I could take those same tricks and use them for his war against nature. For me, it was just a game. For nature, or against nature, I couldn't care less. Just give me a problem and let me work on it, and I'm happy. But it wasn't just a game for him. I think it was 1774 when he really put me to work on it. He hired some mercenaries by then, was raising money and getting all kinds of stuff ready for the war. He wanted steam engines too, like the man said. It was a steam engine time. I got working on factories, railroads, steamships, all the rest. He already had some of his people crossing the border into nature to seize bits of territory before then, but the 18th century, that's when the invasion started for real. I started to stand next to him at the big rallies he liked to hold in those days, with all the soldiers standing in long lines, and he'd go into these wild rants about the glorious future we were going to see once nature was conquered. The soldiers loved it. They cheered and grabbed their scientific instruments and lab coats and go conquer another province of nature. The triumphant years. It was 1859, technology recalled, when that man first started using petroleum. He'd just had this big spat with his dad over this Darwin dude. The worst fight they ever had, and in fact, man never spoke to the old guy again. Man was still steaming about the fight for days afterwards. And then we heard that this guy named Edwin Drake over in Pennsylvania could get you something that was an even bigger rush than coal. Of course, man had to have some. And I said to myself, hey, I'll give it a try. And that was all she wrote, baby. We kept on using coal and a fair bit of it, but there's nothing like petroleum. What's more, man figured out that that's what he needed to finish his conquest of nature. His mercs and a good chunk of nature by then, had a good chunk of nature by then, but not all of it, not even half. And man was having trouble holding some of the territory he'd taken. There were guerrillas behind the lines, that sort of things. He'd pace around at headquarters, snapping at his staff, trying to figure out how to get the edge needed to beat nature once and for all. I've got to have it all, Tech, he'd sometimes say when we were chilling on the couch in his private quarters with a couple of needles and a barrel of petroleum, getting really buzzed. I've conquered distance, the land, the surface of the sea. It's not enough. I want it all. And you know, he got pretty close. Mm. Petroleum was the key, Cleo explained. It wasn't just that man used petroleum. All his soldiers and his support staff were using it too. And over the short term, it's an incredibly powerful drug. It gives users a rush of energy that has to be seen to be believed. Whole provinces of nature that resisted every attack in the first part of the war were overtaken once man started shipping petroleum to his forces. By the 1950s, as a result, the conquest of nature was all but complete. Nature still had a few divisions holed up in an isolated corners where they couldn't be gotten by man's forces, and partisan units were all over the conquered zone, but those were minor irritations at that point. It was easy enough for man and his followers to convince themselves that in a little while the last holdouts would be defeated and nature would be conquered once and for all. That was when reality intervened, though, because all those years of abusing coal, petroleum, and other substances started to catch up with man. He was in bad shape, and he didn't know it. And then he started having problems feeding his addiction. Mm-hmm. On and off the wagon. Mm-hmm. I forget exactly how it happened, technology recounted. It was some kind of disagreement with his suppliers. He was getting a lot of his stuff from some Arab guys at that point, and he got into a fight with them over something, and they said, screw you, man. If you're going to be like that, we're not going to do business with you anymore. So he tried to get the stuff from somebody else, and it turned out the guy from Pennsylvania was out of business, and the connections he had in Texas and California couldn't get enough. The Arab guys had a pretty fair corner on the market, so man went into withdrawal big time. We got him to the hospital, and the doctor took one look at him and said, you got to get him into rehab now. So me and some of his other friends talked him into it. The records of his stays in rehab are heartbreaking, Cleo said, pulling down a tell-all biography from her shelf. He started getting the drug out of his system, convinced himself that he was fine, check out, and would start using again almost immediately. Then, after a little while, he'd have problems getting a fix, end up in withdrawal, and find his way back into rehab. Meanwhile, the war against nature was going badly as the other side learned how to fight back effectively. There were rumors of ceasefire negotiations, even a peace treaty between him and nature. I went to see him in rehab one day, said technology. He looked awful. He looked old, like his dad, every man. He was depressed, too. Talking all the time about this malaise thing. This malaise thing. The thing is, I think if he'd stuck with it, he could have gotten off the stuff and straightened his life out. I really think he could have done it, and I tried to help. I brought him some solar panels, earth-sheltered housing, neat stuff like that, and tried to get him interested in something besides the war on nature and his petroleum habit. That seemed to cheer him up. And I think all his friends had high hopes for a while. Then the next thing I heard, he was out of rehab. He just couldn't hack it any longer. I went to his place, and there he was, laughing and slapping everybody's back and full of big ideas and bigger plans, just like before. That's what it looked like at first, but the magic was gone. He tried to do that comeback career, but he just couldn't get it back together, and things went downhill from there. The final years. The last years of man's career as representative of the human race were troubled. The war against nature wasn't going well by then, Cleo explained. Man's forces were holding on to the most important provinces and cities, but insurgencies were springing up all over. Drug-resistant microbes here, herbicide-tolerant weeds there. Morale was faltering, and a growing fraction of man's forces in the struggle against nature no longer believed in what they were doing. They were in it for the money, nothing more. And the money was running out. Between the costs of the war, the costs of man's lavish lifestyle, and the rising burden of his substance abuse problem, man was in deep financial trouble. There's reason to believe that he may have been engaged in outright fraud to pay his bills during the last few years of his life. Meanwhile, man was becoming increasingly isolated. He'd turned his back on most of his friends, said the anonymous housekeeper quoted earlier. Art, literature, philosophy, he stopped talking to any of them, because they kept telling him to get off the stuff and straighten out his life. I remember the last time science came to a visit. She wanted to talk to man about what he was doing to the atmosphere, and man literally threw her out of the house and slammed the door in her face. I was working downstairs in the laundry, where you usually can't hear much, but I could hear man screaming, "I own the atmosphere! I own the planet! I own the solar system! I own the goddamn stars! They're mine, mine, mine! How dare you tell me what to do with my property?" He went on like that for a while, then collapsed right there in the entry. A couple of us went up, carried him into the bedroom, got him cleaned up, and put him to bed. We had to do that pretty often the last year or so. His longtime friend Technology was apparently the last person to see man alive. "I went over to his place Monday afternoon," Technology recalled. "I went there pretty often, and we'd do some stuff and hang out. And I'd start rapping about all kinds of crazy stuff. Omniscient supercomputers, immortal robot bodies, stuff like that," I told him. "Look, man, if you want to get into stuff like omniscience and immortality, go talk to religion. That's her bag, not mine." But he didn't want to do that. He had some kind of falling out with her a while back, you know, and he wanted to hear it from me. So I talked it up. It got him to mellow out and unwind, and that's what mattered to me. Monday, though, we got to talking, and it turns out that the petroleum he was using, that he had from this really dirty underground source in North Dakota. I said to him, "Man, what the frack were you thinking?" He just looked at me and said, "I've got to have this stuff, Tech. I got to have this stuff." Then he started blubbering, and I reached out to, like, pat his shoulder, and he just blew up at me. He started yelling about how it was all my fault that he was hooked on petroleum. My fault the war on nature wasn't going well. My fault that about this and that and blah, blah, blah. And then he got up and stormed out of the room and slammed the door behind him. I should have gone after him. I know I should have. But instead, I just shook my head and left. Maybe if I'd gone and tried to talk him down, he wouldn't have done it. Everything was quiet, the housekeeper said. Too quiet. Usually we'd hear man walking around, or he'd, you know, put on some music or something. But Monday night, the place might have well have been empty. About 10 o'clock, we were really starting to wonder if something was wrong, and two of us from the housekeeping staff decided that we really had to go check on man to make sure he was all right. We found him in the bathroom, lying on the floor. It was horrible. The room stank with crude oil, and there was the needle and all the other gear scattered around the floor. We tried to find a pulse, but he was already cold and stiff. I went and called for an ambulance anyway, and, well, you know the rest. The troubled aftermath. Man's death leaves a great many questions unanswered. By the time everyone died, Cleo explained, everyone knew who his heir would be. Man had already taken over his father's role as humanity's idealized self-image. That hasn't happened this time, as you know. Man didn't leave a will, and his estate is a mess. It may be years before his lawyers and the accountants finish going through his affairs and figure out whether there's going to be anything at all for potential heirs to claim. Meanwhile, there are at least half a dozen contenders for the role of abstract representation of the human race, and none of them is a clear favorite. It may be a long time before all the consequences are sorted out. Meanwhile, one of the most important voices in the debate has already registered an opinion. Following her invariable habit, Gaia refused to grant any personal interviews, but a written statement to the media was delivered by a spokesrabbit on Tuesday evening. Quote, "Please accept my sympathy for the tragic demise of man, the would-be conqueror of nature," it read. "I hope it will not be out of place, though, to suggest that whoever my human children select as their new self-image might consider being a little less self-centered, not to mention a little less self-destructive." Mm. Wow. Mm. I love that. A Christmas Speculation. Originally published the 25th of December, 2013. Regular readers of this blog will be aware that I have spent most of the last year discussing the place of religion in the troubled future ahead of us. This series of posts mentioned here became the raw material for my book, After Progress, which Michael Dowd blurbed.
Yeah.
This holiday season, in which millions of Americans have just engaged in an all-out orgy of conspicuous consumption and mindless waste to celebrate the birth of a poor carpenter's son in a stable in Bethlehem, also has me thinking about religious matters. And it occurs to me that there's an issue along these lines that my blog posts haven't yet explored. It may not have much to do with the future of modern industrial world, but it may just explain a thing or two about the present and the recent past here in the United States. I'm sorry to say that the issue I have in mind has a distinct partisan dimension, which marks a break from my usual policy in this blog. One of the more common criticisms I feel from irate readers, in fact, is the insistence that I treat politicians of both major U.S. parties as though they're interchangeable. It's a valid criticism, since I do indeed do this.
Yes, he does.
And the only justification I can offer it is that, by and large, that's the way they behave. For Exhibit A, it's hard to beat the current inmate of the White House, who won the presidency just over 5 years ago in a flurry of sound bites about hope and change, and then turned around and gave us a truly inspired imitation of the third and fourth terms of George... An inspired imitation of the third and fourth terms of George W. Bush, complete with all the drone strikes and violations of civil liberties, and his chorus of sycophants in the media, used to insist that he was sure to abolish once he got in office. Still, the criticism has some credit, since there's one significant difference between the two major U.S. parties. Most Democratic politicians, like the example just cited, will say and do whatever it takes to get elected, and then conveniently forget all about their alleged ideals in order to proceed with and profit from the ordinary business of politics once they land in office. A fair number of Republican politicians do exactly the same thing, to be sure. But there's also a large number of Republicans who have convictions regarding important social issues and cling firmly to those convictions even when they're not popular. That's a distinction worth noting, but a certain amount of confusion enters the picture when the Republican in question, as nearly all of them do, insists that their convictions follow from their Christian faith. Now, of course, the Christian faith does have quite a bit to say about social issues. Theologies differ from church to church, but friends of mine in several different denominations assure me that the words of Jesus quoted in the four Gospels in the New Testament are considered definitive guides to faith and morals. So I sat down a few days ago with a copy of the King James Version and spent an afternoon reading the Gospels. Not, by the way, for the first time. Here are the passages I found in which Jesus tells his followers that they have a duty to take care of children, the poor, and other vulnerable people. Matthew 18:6, 18:10, 19:21, 23:14 and 25:31 through 46, Mark 9:36 through 37, 10 through 20, verse 10:21 and 12:40, and Luke chapter 10 verses 30 through 37, 11:41, chapter 12, 33, 14, 12 through 14, 18, 22, and chapter 20, verse 47. Here are the passages in which Jesus tells his followers to pay their taxes without complaining. Matthew 5, 42, 17, 24 through 27, and 22, 19 through 21. Mark 12, 14 through 17, and Luke 6, 30, and 20, 21 through 25. Here are the passages in which Jesus tells his followers that they aren't supposed to obsess about other people's sins, but should leave that to God and attend to their own moral failings instead. Matthew 7, 1 through 5, and 9, 10 through, 10 through 13. Mark 2, 15 through 17. Luke 6, 37. 6, 41 through 42. 7, 48, 44 through 48. 15, 2. 18, 10 through 14. And 19, verse 7, and John chapter 8, verses 2 through 11. And here are the passages in which Jesus tells his followers to blame the poor and vulnerable for their plight, direct benefits toward the already well-to-do at the expense of everyone else, refuse to pay their fair share of taxes, and obsessively denounce and punish the sins of people that they don't like, while finding every opportunity to excuse their own sins and those of their friends. Zero. Yet these latter are the things that a great many Republicans, and in particular a great many of those Republicans who claim to be motivated by their Christian faith, have been pursuing in practice, if not always advocating in theory. If they're deriving their commitments from a religion, it's pretty clearly not the one taught by Jesus. Many people have made the same point in recent years, but it doesn't seem to have occurred to any of them that another religion that's active in today's America does teach all the things the GOP supports. That religion, of course, is Satanism, and more specifically, the version of it taught by Anton LaVey's The Satanic Bible. Those who were around during LaVey's glory days in the 1970s, when he appeared regularly on talk shows and had a coterie of Hollywood stars in his Church of Satan, will doubtless remember the Satanic Bible. For those who weren't, it's a book-length screed denouncing Christian morality and upholding an ethic of raw selfishness that might makes right. It's very much still in copyright, so I'm not going to quote it here. But any reader who turns its pages will find the present social policy of the GOP precisely reflected in LaVey's dismissal of 2,000 years of Christian teaching about our duty to care for one another, his shrill denunciations of the vulnerable and needy as parasites and vampires, and his insistence that the successful owe nothing to anybody else. An interesting coincidence, or perhaps an ironic one? Maybe so, but I find myself wondering if there's more to it than that. It happens fairly often that the repeated failure of a belief system causes many former believers to swing all the way to the opposite extreme and embrace the antithesis of their former faith. The neoconservatives who briefly and disastrously shaped the direction of U.S. foreign policy in the first years of this century are a case in point. Many of the leaders of that movement were doctrinaire Marxists during their college years and responded to the abject failure of Marxism by doing their level best to become the wicked capitalists that they once so fervently denounced. The evangelical revival of the late 70s and 80s, in turn, was pervaded by hopes at least as extreme and unrealistic as anything the Marxists envisioned in their heyday. Wildly popular books, such as Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth, convinced millions of newly born-again Christians that the Second Coming was due any minute, and the repeated failure of Jesus to show up on cue must have put immense psychological strains on a great many people who cut their ties to the secular world in the imminent expectation of Armageddon. All through those same years, in turn, copies of the Satanic Bible could be found in cheap mass-market editions on the shelves of chain stores, bookstores all over America. It's not hard to imagine how, after each loudly proclaimed date for the rapture waltzed serenely by without incident, a trickle of not quite former fundamentalists could well have responded to their feelings of humiliation and despair by walking away from the Bible section in those same bookstores and heading it and seeing if the opposite side had something better on offer. Those who found solace of one sort or another in LaVey's evocation of diabolical values would have had several good reasons not to make their change of heart public, to be sure. On the one hand, or horn, or cloven hoof, a public confession of devil worship would have been difficult to explain to one's employer in those somewhat more innocent times, and the reactions of one's presumably Christian friends and family would have been an issue for many. On the other, one of the classic titles given Satan by Christian theologians is the father of lies, and it's easy to see how the thought of remaining ostensibly Christian while practicing devil worship in private and perhaps leading others down the left-hand path might have seemed like a more delectable option available to those new satanic converts. Nor would active membership in most of today's Christian churches have been any impediment to the enthusiastic worship of Satan. According to Matthew 7:21, it's not hard to say, "Lord, Lord," to qualify as a Christian. It's also necessary to do the will of God, a requirement that, as noted above, involves, among other things, some highly specific commitments to help the poor and vulnerable. Thus, covert devil worshippers could shout "Jesus is Lord" at the top of their lungs every Sunday, and so long as they carefully refrained from following the teachings of the Gospels, they would have had no difficulty maintaining their status as Satanists in good standing. This, it seems, they accordingly did. As the number of devil worshippers in evangelical churches and the Christian end of the Republican Party increased, though, the most pressing need would have been some surreptitious way to signal their involvement to those who shared their convictions, without believers in the Christian gospel being any the wiser. Coming up with a satanic shibboleth that would be instantly recognizable to other devil worshippers, but completely opaque to devout Christians, might seem like a tall order. But it's one that seems to have been met with aplomb. Yes, this is where we discuss Ayn Rand.
Oh.
All things considered, Rand's cult status in those circles that call themselves conservative these days is hard to explain because Rand was not a conservative. By that, I don't simply mean that she rejected the term and savagely denounced conservative ideas and politicians, though this is true, nor that the conservative movement in her time rejected her ideas with at least as much energy as she did theirs, and generally with better logic than hers, though this is also the case. Far more important here is that she was a radical ideologue of exactly the sort against which the founders of conservatism directed their most barbed and thoughtful critiques. As discussed in Russell Kirk's brilliant study, The Conservative Mind, classical conservatism has at its core an enduring and wholly justified suspicion of claims that some abstract ideology or other can bring about heaven on earth. The pretended rights of these theorists, explains Edmund Burke, are all extremes, and in proportion they are metaphysically true, they are morally and politically false. Unquote. He was talking about the Jacobins, but he could just as well have been talking about Rand. Still, there's another point that's worth making here, which is that Ayn Rand was a violent opponent of Christianity and Christian morality, a committed atheist who considered selfishness a central moral virtue, and who also idealized one of the most disgusting child murderers of the 20th century. And a footnote to a website there. Her present role as intellectual pinup girl for people who call themselves conservative Christian conservatives is thus a little odd, since claiming to be a Christian and a believer in Rand's teachings at the same time is right up there with claiming to be a vegetarian carnivore or a celibate harlot. It's not just that one of these things is not like the other. Rand's teachings are flatly, openly, and deliberately opposed to every part of the gospel of Jesus. Mm. Rand's anti-communism made her turgid novels popular in the less thoughtful end of the American right in the 1950s and 1960s. Though, and that accident of history prepared her for what might just be her core role as in contemporary culture. A covert way for devil worshippers to identify themselves to one another in the supposedly Christian, and just the supposedly conservative, GOP of today. Closet Satanists attending fundamentalist churches, church services, or Republican Party get-togethers can't exactly sport upside-down pentagrams on their shirts, or greet each other attendees with a hearty Hail Satan. But a casual reference to one of Rand's novels or pseudo-philosophical screeds is the next best thing. Once someone else responds enthusiastically to the mention of Rand's name, a few other seemingly casual comments and perhaps a covert devil sign or two would be enough to settle the matter. All this may suggest some sobering reflection as we approach the beginning of another U.S. election year, in which most races will pin a candidate from a party that puts its faith in Lucifer against a candidate from a party that, for all practical purposes, believes in nothing at all. Still, when supposedly Christian politicians start waxing rhapsodic about the alleged intellectual or literary virtues of Ayn Rand, I trust my readers will remember that what they're saying actually works out to, "I worship the Prince of Darkness, and you should too." Any of my readers who happen to be devil worshippers themselves can proceed to welcome them as friends and brothers, while those of other faiths can cast their votes as their own ethical views suggest. On the off chance that any Republican Satanists are reading these lines, though, I'd like to offer a helpful suggestion. The long charade of pretending to be Christian conservatives has no doubt been great fun. And it certainly succeeded in getting satanic ideas widely accepted all through those parts of American society that might otherwise have been expected to resist them most forcefully. Only one of the seven deadly sins has gotten by without extravagant praise from so-called Christian conservatives in recent years. It's hard to glorify as an economic system that depends on avarice, gluttony, envy, and sloth, and a foreign policy defined by pride and wrath in any other way. And no doubt they'll find a way to fit lust in there somewhere one of these days and finish collecting the whole set. At this point, though, it's hard to see any reason why the Satanists in the GOP need to keep the pretense going any longer. In an era when most discussions of the Christmas season in the mass media fixate on whether retailers are making a big enough profit to keep the economy stumbling blindly onward for one more year, I think a strong case can be made that America is ready to shake off the last of its qualms and openly embrace a satanic political agenda. Among its other benefits, putting public devil worship at the heart of the GOP, where it evidently belongs, can't help but improve the flagging ratings of Republican national conventions. The otherwise tedious proceedings of the 2016 GOP convention, for example, would be enlivened no end by a black mass celebrated by the GOP nominee, perhaps with Ann Coulter, nude form draped over the altar, and a chorus of delegates chanting, "Evil, be thou my good," from the bleachers. In the meantime, I would like to wish to those of my readers who actually believe in the gospel of Jesus, who study his teachings prayerfully, and try to their level best to live their lives in accordance with them, a very Merry Christmas. To my other readers, blessings on whatever holiday you celebrate in this season of hope's rebirth, in a cold and bitter time, and to all, a happy new year.
Wow.
This guy is fucking brilliant.
Yes, he is.
The Crocodiles of Reality. Originally published the 12th of March, 2014. I've suggested in several previous posts that the peak oil debate may be approaching a turning point. one of those shifts in the collective conversation in which topics that have been shut out for years or decades finally succeed in crashing the party, and other topics that have gotten more than their quota of attention during that time get put out to pasture or sent to the glue factory. I'd like to talk for a moment about some of the reasons I think that's about to happen, and in the process, give a name to one of the common but generally unmentioned features of contemporary economic life. We can begin with the fracking bubble, that misbegotten brat fathered by Wall Street's love of Ponzi schemes or on Main Street's stark terror of facing up to the end of the age of cheap, abundant energy. Wow. I'm gonna read that again. We begin with the fracking bubble, that misbegotten brat, fathered by Wall Street's love of Ponzi schemes on Main Street's stark terror of facing up to the end of the age of cheap, abundant energy.
Yes.
That bubble has at least two significant functions in today's world. The first function, as we discussed in these essays already, is to fill an otherwise vacant niche in the string of giddy speculative delusions that began with the stock market boom and bust of 1987 and is still going strong today. As with previous examples, the promoters of the fracking bubble dangled the prospect of what used to be normal returns on investment in front of the eager and clueless investors with which America seems to be richly stocked these days.
Yeah.
These then leapt at the bait and handed their money over to the tender mercies of the same Wall Street investment firms who gave us Pets.com and zero-doc mortgages. You may think, dear reader, that after a quarter century of this, there might be a shortage of chumps willing to fall for such schemes. Whatever else might be depleting, though, the supply of lambs eager to be led to that particular slaughter seems to be keeping up handily with the demand. We live in what will doubtless be remembered as the golden age of financial fraud.
Ooh.
An era of stunning fiscal idiocy in which even the most blatant swindles can count on drawing a crowd of suckers begging to have their money taken from them. Millennia from now, the grifters, con men, and bunco artists of civilizations yet unborn will look back in awe at our time and wish that they, too, might be fortunate enough to live in an era when tens of millions of investors passionately waited to believe that the laws of economics, thermodynamics, and plain common sense must surely be suspended for their benefit. To some extent, in other words, the fracking bubble is simply one more reminder that Ben Franklin's adage about a fool and his money have not lost any of its relevance since the old rascal slipped it into the pages of Poor Richard's Almanac. Still, there's more going on here than the ruthless fleecing of the unwary. That's the lifeblood of every healthy market economy. The fracking bubble, as most of my readers will well be aware, has not only served as an excuse for ordinary speculative larceny, it's also provided a very large number of people with an excuse to scrunch up their eyes, stuff their fingers in their ears, shout, "La, la, la, I can't hear you," and thus keep clinging to the absurd faith that limitless resources really can be extracted from a finite planet. For the last 3 or 4 years, accordingly, the fracking bubble has been the most common item brandished by practitioners of peak oil denial as evidence that the petroleum production can, too, keep on increasing forever. So there! The very modest additions to global petroleum production that resulted from hydrofracturing shales in the North Dakota and Texas got talked up into an imaginary tidal wave of crude oil that would supposedly sweep all before it, and not incidentally, restore the United States to its long-vanished status as the world's premier oil producer. All that made good copy for bunco artists mentioned earlier, to be sure, but it also fed into futile attempts at denial that have taken place of a sane energy policy in most industrial societies. The problem with this fond fantasy is that the numbers don't even begin to add up. Each year, on average, the oil industry has had to increase its investments by 10% over the previous year to get the same amount of oil out of the ground. Even $100 a barrel oil prices won't support that kind of soaring overhead costs for long. And the problem has been made worse by the belated discovery that many of the shale beds ballyhooed in recent years don't have anything like as much oil as their promoters claimed. As a result, oil companies around the world are cutting back on capital investment and selling off assets. That's not the behavior of an industry poised on the brink of a new age of abundance. It's the behavior of an industry that has just slammed face first into hard supply limits and is backing away groggily from the impact site while trying to staunch the bleeding from deep fiscal cuts. As a result, with mathematical certainty, a great many overpriced assets are going to lose most of their paper value in the years ahead. A great many businesses that have made their money providing goods and services to the drilling industry are going to downsize sharply or simply go bankrupt. A great many wells that can't make money, even at exorbitant oil prices, are going to be shut in or go undrilled in the first place. And a very, very great number of people who convinced themselves that they were going to get rich by investing in fracking are going to end up poor. It's not going to be pretty. Exactly what effect this is going to have on the price of oil is an interesting question. My guess, though it's only a guess, is that a couple of years from now, the price of oil will spike, possibly to the $250 to $300 a barrel range, then crash to $60 a barrel, and slowly recover to $175 or so over a period of several years.
Whoa, when did he write this?
He wrote this a year ago.
And it was
March of 2014.
It was like November, December.
Yeah, it was actually a few months after this that it plunged, and it hasn't gone back up yet.
Yeah.
This has had a great deal of relevance to the project of this blog. The last time petroleum production failed to keep pace with potential demand, the price of oil spiked accordingly. Peak oil came in from the fringes and got discussed publicly in the pages of newspapers of record. That window of opportunity gaped open from 2004 to 2010, roughly speaking, and during that period, a great deal got accomplished. That was when peak oil stopped being a concern of the farthest fringe and found an audience in many corners of contemporary alternative culture. When local groups, some under the Transition Town banner, others outside it, began to organize around the imminence of peak oil, and when books on resource depletion and its consequences found a market for the first time since the early 1980s. Those are significant gains. It's true, of course, that these achievements didn't make peak oil go away or find some gimmick that would keep the lifestyles of the industrial world's more privileged inmates rolling merrily along for the foreseeable future. What sometimes gets forgotten is that neither of those things was ever possible in the first place. The hard facts of our predicament have not changed a bit. The age of cheap, abundant energy is ending. The economic systems, social structures, and lifestyle habits that were made possible by that temporary condition are accordingly going away, and nothing anyone can do will bring them back again. Not now, not ever. It's worth being precise here. For the rest of the time our species endures, we will have to deal with much more sharply constrained energy supplies than we've had handily over the last few centuries. For the rest of the time our species endures, we will have to deal with much sharper constrained energy supplies than we've had handily over the last few centuries. That doesn't mean that our descendants will be condemned to huddle in caves until the jaws of extinction close around them. I've argued at quite length in one of my books, The Ecotechnic Future, that the end point of the mess we're currently in, centuries from now, will most likely be in the emergence of ecotechnic societies, societies that maintain relatively high technology at the modest energy and resource inputs that can be provided by renewable sources. I've suggested there and elsewhere that there's quite a bit that can be done here and now to lay the foundations for the ecotechnic societies of the far future. I've also tried to point out that there's quite a bit that can be done here and now to make the unraveling of the age of abundance less traumatic than it will otherwise be. To my mind, those are worthwhile goals. What makes them difficult is simply that any meaningful attempt to pursue them has to start by accepting that the age of cheap, abundant energy is ending, and that the lifestyles that age made possible are ending with it, and that wasting all those fossil fuels on what amounts to a drunken binge 3 centuries long might not have been a very smart idea in the first place. Any one of those would be a bitter pill to take. All three of them together are far more than most people nowadays are willing to swallow. And so it's not surprising that so much effort over the last few decades have gone into pretending that the squalid excesses of contemporary culture that can somehow keep rolling along in the teeth of all the evidence to the contrary. The frantic attempts to sustain the unsustainable, driven by this pretense, have done much to make the present day such a halcyon time for swindles of every description. Not all of those, however, have taken aim at the wallets of what we might as well call the lumpen investmentariat, that class of people who have money to invest and not a clue in their heads that Wall Street might not have their best interests at heart. Some of the most colorful flops in recent years have instead attracted money from different, though equally gullible source, government subsidies for new energy technologies. Those of my readers who were part of the peak oil scene a decade ago, for example, may remember the days when ethanol made from American corn was going to save us all. Many of the claims made more recently to inflate the fracking bubble were used to justify what was described at the time as America's burgeoning new ethanol industry. But the target for those exercises was somewhat different. A certain amount of investment money from the clueless did find its way into the hands of ethanol plant promoters, to be sure. But the financial core of the new industry was a flurry of federal mandates and federal and state subsidies, which in theory existed to lead America to a bright new energy future, and in practice existed to convince the voters that politicians were really doing something about gasoline prices that had just risen to the unheard-of level of $2 a gallon. You won't hear much about America's burgeoning new ethanol industry these days. A substantial fraction of the ethanol plants that were subsidized by governments and lavishly praised by politicians a decade ago are bankrupt and shuttered today, having failed to turn a profit or, in some cases, cover the costs of construction. The critics who pointed out that the burgeoning new industry made no economic sense and that making ethanol from corn uses more energy than you get from burning the ethanol turned out to be dead right, and the critics who dismissed them as naysayers turned out to be dead wrong. Still, the ethanol plants accomplished the same two functions as the fracking bubble did later. They sucked a great deal of money into the hands of their promoters and helped everyone else pretend for a while that the end of the age of cheap, abundant energy wasn't going to happen after all. It's hardly the only example of the phenomenon. Since I don't want green energy proponents to feel unduly picked on, let's turn to the other side of the energy picture and take a look at nuclear fusion. Since the 1950s, a sizable body of nuclear physicists have kept themselves gainfully employed and their laboratories stocked and staffed by promoting nuclear fusion as the wave of the future. In just another 20 years, we've been repeatedly told, clean, safe, nuclear fusion plants will be churning out endless supplies of energy if only government subsidies keep pouring in. After 60 years of unbroken failure, even politicians are starting to have second thoughts. But the fusion power industry keeps at it, pursuing a project that, as respected science writer Charles Cief pointed out trenchantly in his book Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking, has more in common with the quest for perpetual motion than its overeager fans like to think. Every few years, the media thus carries yet another enthusiastic announcement that some new breakthrough has happened in the quest for fusion power. Now, of course, it's worth noting that none of these widely ballyhooed breakthroughs ever amounts to a working fusion reactor capable of putting power into the grid, but let's let that one pass for now, because the point I want to make is a different one. As I pointed out in a post here last year, the question that matters about fusion is not whether fusion power is technically feasible, but whether it's economically viable. That's not a question anyone in the fusion research industry wants to discuss, and there are good reasons for that. The ITER project in Europe offers a glimpse at the answer. ITER is the most complex and the most expensive machine ever built by human beings. The latest estimate of the total cost has recently gone up from $14 billion to $17 billion. And if past performance is anything to go by, it will have gone up a good deal more before the scheduled completion in 2020. That stratospheric price tag results from the simple fact that six decades of hard work by physicists around the world exploring scores of different approaches to fusion have shown that anything less expensive won't produce a sustained fusion reaction. While commercial fusion reactors would doubtless cost less than ITER, it's already clear that they won't cost enough less to make fusion power economically viable. Even if ITER succeeds in creating its sun in a bottle, in other words, that fact will be an expensive laboratory curiosity, not a solution to the world's energy needs. My more attentive readers will doubtless have noticed that the flaw in the current round of glowing prophecies of a future powered by fusion plants is the same as the flaw in the equally glowing sales pitches for corn-based ethanol plants a decade ago. Turning corn into ethanol and using the ethanol to fuel cars and trucks is technically feasible. It just doesn't happen to be economically viable. In the same way, whether fusion power is technically feasible or not may still be up in the air, but the question of its economic viability is not. The gap between technical capacity and economic reality provides the ecological niche in which both these projects make their home, and a great many other alleged solutions to the energy crisis of our time exploit that same niche. I'd like to suggest that it's high time to put a name to the technological fauna that fill this role in our social ecology, and I have a name to propose. I think we should call them subsidy dumpsters. A subsidy dumpster, if I may venture on a definition, is an energy technology that looks like a viable option so long as nobody pays attention to economic realities. Because it's technically feasible, or at least hasn't yet been proven to be unfeasible, promoters can brandish enthusiastic estimates of how much energy it will yield if only governments provide adequate funding, and point to laboratory tests of technical feasibility as evidence that so tempting a bait is within reach. The promoters of such schemes can also rely on the foam-flecked ravings of economists who have proven to be so stunningly clueless about energy in recent years, and they can also count on one of the pervasive blind spots in modern thinking, the almost visceral inability of most people these days to think in terms of whole systems. Armed with these advantages, they descend upon politicians, and if energy costs are an irritation to the public, and these days energy costs are always an irritation to the public, the politicians duly cough up a subsidy so that they can claim to be doing something about the energy problem. Once the subsidy dumpster gets its funding, it goes through however many twists and turns its promoters can manage before economic realities take the inevitable toll. If the dumpster in question has to compete in the marketplace, as fuel ethanol plants did, the normal result is a series of messy bankruptcies as soon as the government money runs short. If it can be shielded from the market, preferably by always being almost ready for commercial development but never actually quite getting there, the fusion research industry has this one down pat, though it's fair to say that the laws of nature seem to be giving them a great deal of help. The dumpster can keep on being filled with subsidies for as long as the prospect of an imminent breakthrough can be dangled in front of politicians and the public. Since most of people these days consistently mistake technical feasibility for economic viability, there's no shortage of easy marks for this sort of sales pitch. There are plenty of subsidy dumpsters in the energy field just now. What makes this all the more unfortunate is that quite a few of them are based on technologies that could have been used in less self-defeating ways. Solar power, to name only one example, could make a huge dent in America's energy needs if the available resources focused on proven technologies such as solar water heaters. Once this sensible approach is replaced by attempts to claim that we can keep the grid powered by paving some substantial fraction of Nevada with solar PV cells, though, we're in subsidy dumpster territory, as recent study in Spain's much-lauded solar program has shown. Renewable energy is a viable option so long as its sharp limits of concentration and intermittency are kept in mind. Ignore those and pretend that we can keep on living today's extravagant lifestyles on a basis that won't support them, and you've got a perfect recipe for a subsidy dumpster. Now it's only fair to point out that the energy issue is far from the only dimension of modern life that attracts subsidy dumpsters. Name a current crisis here in America: joblessness, urban plight, decaying infrastructure, and the list goes on. And there are plenty of subsidy dumpsters to be found, some empty and rusting like yesterday's ethanol plants, some soaking up government funds like the ITER project, and many more that are still only a twinkle in the eyes of their eager promoters. Still, I'd like to suggest that subsidy dumpsters in the energy field have a particular importance just now. The end of the age of cheap, abundant energy requires that we stop using anything like as much energy as we've been using in recent decades. Any approach to dealing with the crisis of our age that doesn't start by using much less energy, in other words, simply isn't serious. The parade of subsidy dumpsters being hawked to politicians these days is merely one more attempt to refuse to take our predicament as seriously as it deserves, and thus serves mostly as a way to make that predicament even worse than it has to be. By and large, to borrow a neatly pharaonic turn of the phrase from one of my longtime readers, tip of the arch-jeweled hat to Robin Datta, that's the trouble with spending all your time splashing about in the waters of denial. All that happens in the final analysis is that you attract the attention of the crocodiles of reality. Refusing the Call, a Tale Rewritten. Originally published on the 23rd of April, 2014. I've been wondering for some time now how to talk about the weirdly autumnal tone that sounds so often and so clearly in America these days. Through the babble and clatter, the 7 or 8 television screens yelling from the walls of every restaurant you pass, and all the rest of it, there comes a mood that turns shrill, sullen, and self-pitying, as though even the people who insist most loudly that it's all onward and upward from here don't believe it anymore, and those for whom the old optimism stopped being more than a soothing shibboleth a long time ago are hunching their shoulders, shutting their eyes, and hoping that things can still hold together for just a little while longer. It's not just that American politicians and pundits are insisting at the top of their lungs that that the United States can threaten Russia with natural gas surpluses that don't exist, though that's admittedly a very bad sign all by itself. It's that this orgy of self-congratulatory nonsense appears in the news right next to reports that oil and gas companies are slashing their investments in the fracking technology and shale leases that were supposed to produce those imaginary surpluses, having lost a great deal of money pursuing the shale oil mirage, while Russia and Iran pursue trade deals that will make U.S. sanctions against both countries all but irrelevant. And China is quietly arranging to conduct its trade with Europe in yuan rather than dollars. Strong nations in control of their own destinies, it's fair to note, don't respond to challenges on this scale by plunging their heads quite so enthusiastically into the sands of self-deception. That is to say, the long day of national delusion that dawned back in 1980, when Ronald Reagan famously and fatuously proclaimed, "It's morning in America," is drawing on rapidly toward dusk, and most Americans are hopelessly unprepared for the coming of night. They're unprepared in practical terms, that is, for an era in which the 5% of us who live in the United States will no longer dispose of a quarter of the world's energy supply and a third of its raw materials and industrial products, and in which what currently counts as a normal American lifestyle will soon be no more than a fading memory for the vast majority. They're just as unprepared, though, for the psychological and emotional costs of that shattering transformation, not least because the challenge isn't being imposed on them at random by an indifferent universe, but comes as the inevitable consequence of their own collective choices in decades not that long past. The hard fact that most people in this country are trying not to remember is this. In the years right after Reagan's election, a vast number of Americans enthusiastically turned their backs on the promising steps towards sustainability that had been taken in the previous decade. Abandoning the ideals they'd been praising to the skies up till that time, and cashed in their grandchildren's future so that they didn't have to give up the extravagances and waste that define their familiar and comfortable lifestyles. As a direct result, the non-renewable resources that might have supported the transition to a sustainable future went instead to fuel one last orgy of wretched excess. Now, though, the party is over. The bill is due, and the consequences of that disastrous decision have become a massive, though almost wholly unmentionable factor in our nation's culture and collective psychology. A great many of the more disturbing features of contemporary American life, I'm convinced, can't be understood unless America's 30-year vacation from reality is taken into account. A sixth of the U.S. population is currently on antidepressant medications. And since maybe half of Americans can't afford to get medication at all, the total number of Americans who are clinically depressed is likely a good deal higher than prescription figures suggest. The sort of bizarre delusions that used to count as evidence of serious mental illness, Baroque conspiracy theories thickly frosted with claims of persecution, fantasies of imminent mass death as punishment for humanity's sins, and so on, have become part of the common currency of American folk belief. For that matter, what does our pop culture's frankly necrophiliac obsession with vampires amount to but an attempt, thinly veiled in the most transparent of symbolism, to insist that it really is okay to victimize future generations for centuries down the line in order to prolong one's own existence? Mythic and legends such as this can be remarkably subtle barometers of the collective psyche. The transformation that turned the vampire from just another spooky Eastern European folktale into a massive pop culture presence in industrial North America has quite a bit to say about the unspoken ideas and emotions moving through the crawl spaces of our collective life. In the same way, it's anything but an accident that the myth of the heroic quest has become so pervasive a present in the modern industrial world that Joseph Campbell could simply label it the monomyth, the basic form of myth as such. In any sense other than a wholly parochial one, of course, he was quite wrong. The wild diversity of the world's mythic stories can't be forced into any one narrative pattern. But if we look only at popular culture in the modern industrial world, he's almost right. The story of the callow, C-A-L-L-O-W?
Yeah, callow.
The story of the callow, nobody who answers the call to adventure, goes off. The callow nobody who answers the call to adventure goes off into the unknown, accomplishes some grand task, and returns transformed to transform his surroundings in turn, is firmly welded into place in the imagination of our age. You'll find it at the center of J.R.R. Tolkien's great work of fantasy, in the most forgettable products of the modern entertainment industry, and everything in between and all around. Yet there's a curious blind spot in all this. We hear plenty about those who answer the call to adventure, and nothing at all about those who refuse it. Those latter don't offer much of a plot engine for an adventure story, granted, but such a tale could make for a gripping psychological study, and one that has some uncomfortably familiar features. With that in mind, with an apology in the direction of Tolkien's ghost, and with another to those of my readers who aren't lifelong Tolkien buffs, with a head full of Middle Earth trivia, yes, I used the sign school yearbooks in fluent Elfish, I'd like to suggest a brief visit to the alternative Middle Earth, one in which Frodo Baggins, facing the final crisis of the Third Age and the need to leave behind everything he knew and loved in order to take the ring to Mount Doom, crumpled instead with a cry of, "I can't, Gandalf. I just can't." Perhaps you'll join me in a quiet corner of the Green Dragon, the best inn in Bywater, take a mug of ale from the buxom hobbit barmaid, and talk about old Frodo, who lived until recently just up the road and across the bridge in Hobbiton. I'm going to botch up a lot of these names, but there you have it. You've heard about the magic ring he had, the one that he inherited from his uncle Bilbo, the one that Gandalf the Wizard wanted him to go off and destroy. That was 30 years ago, and most folks in the Shire have heard rumors about it by now. Yes, it's quite true. Frodo was supposed to leave the Shire and go off on an adventure, as Bilbo did before him, and couldn't bring himself to do it. He had plenty of reasons to stay home, to be sure. He was tolerably well off and quite comfortable. All his friends and connections were here, and the journey would have been difficult and dangerous. Nor was there any certainty of success. Quite the contrary, it's entirely possible that he might have perished somewhere in the wildlands or been caught by the Dark Lord's servants or what have you. So he refused. And when Gandalf tried to talk him out of it, he threw the old wizard out of Bag End and slammed the round green door in his face. Have you ever seen someone in a fight who knows that he's in the wrong and knows that everyone else knows it? And that knowledge just makes him even more angry and stubborn. That was Frodo just then. Friends of mine watched the whole thing, or as much of it as could be seen from outside, from the garden outside, and it was not a pleasant spectacle. It's what happened thereafter, though, that bears recalling. I'm quite sure that if Frodo had shown the least sign of leaving the Shire and going on a quest, Sauron would have sent black riders after him in a fine hurry. And there's no telling what else might have come boiling up out of Mordor. It's by no means impossible that the Dark Lord might have panicked and launched a hastily ill-advised assault on Gandor right away. For all I know, that may have been what Gandalf had in mind, tricking the Dark Lord into overreacting before he'd gathered his full strength and before Gandor and Rohan had been thoroughly weakened from within. Still, once Sauron's spies brought him word that Frodo had refused to embark on the quest, the Dark Lord knew that he had a good deal less to fear, and that he could afford to take his time. Ever since then, there have been plenty of servants of Mordor in and around the Shire, and a black rider or two keeping watch nearby, but nothing obvious or direct, nothing that might rouse whatever courage Frodo might have left or convince him that he had to flee for his life. Sauron was willing to be patient. Patient and cruel. I'm quite sure he knew perfectly well what the rest of Frodo's life would be like. So Gandalf went away and Frodo stayed in Bag End. And for years thereafter, it seemed as though the whole business had been no more than a mistake. The news that came from Greenway, from the southern lands, was no worse than before. Gandor stood firm. And though there was said to be some kind of trouble in Rohan, well, that was only to be expected now and then. Frodo even took a joking about how gullible he'd been to believe all those alarmist claims that Gandalf had made. Sauron was still safely cooped up in Mordor, and all seemed right with Middle-earth. Of course, part of that was simply that Frodo had gotten even wealthier and more comfortable than he'd been before. He patched up his relationship with the Sackville Bagginses, and he invested a good deal of money in Sandyman's Hill in Hobbiton, which paid off handsomely. He no longer spent time with many of his younger friends by then, partly because they had their own opinions about what he should have done, and partly because he had business connections with some of the wealthiest hobbits in the Shire and wanted to build on those. He no longer took long walks around the Shire, as he'd done before, and he gave up visiting elves and dwarves when he stopped speaking to Gandalf. But of course, the rumors and news from the southern lands slowly but surely turned to worse, as the Dark Lord gathered his power and tightened his grip on the western lands a little at a time. I recall when Rohan fell to Sauron's goblin armies. That was a shock for a great many folk, here in the Shire and elsewhere. Soon thereafter, though, Frodo was claiming that, after all, Saruman wasn't Sauron, and Rohan wasn't that important. And for all anybody knew, the wizard and the Dark Lord might well end up at each other's throats and spare the rest of us. Oh, I see. Rohan fell to Saruman. Okay. Still, it was around that time that Frodo stopped joking about Gandalf's warnings and got angry if anyone mentioned them in his hearing. It was around that time, too, that he started insisting loudly and often that someone would surely stop Sauron. One day, it was the elves. After all, they had three rings of power and could surely overwhelm the forces of Mordor if they chose to. Another day, the dwarves would do it, or Sormon, or the men of Gondor, or the Valar in the utmost west. There were so many alternatives. His friends very quickly learned to nod and agree with him, for he would lose his temper and start shouting at them if they disagreed or even asked questions. When Lorien was destroyed, that was another shock. It was after that, as I recall, that Frodo started hinting darkly that the elves didn't seem to be doing anything with their three rings of power to stop Sauron, and maybe they weren't as opposed to him as they'd claimed. He came up with any number of theories about this or that elfish conspiracy. The first troubles were starting to affect the Shire by then, of course, and his investments were beginning to lose money. It was probably inevitable that he would start claiming that the conspiracy was aimed in part against hobbits, against the Shire, or against him in particular, especially the latter. They wanted his ring, of course. That played an even larger and larger role in his talk as the years passed. I don't recall hearing of any of the particular change in his thinking when word came that Minas Tirith had been taken by the Dark Lord's armies. But it wasn't that much later that a great many elves came hurrying along the east road through the Shire, and a few months after that, the word that Rivendell had fallen. That was not merely a shock, but a blow. Frodo had grown up hearing his uncle's stories about Rivendell and the elves and the half-elves who lived there. There was a time after that news came that some of us briefly wondered if old Frodo might actually find it in himself to do the thing he'd refused to do all those years before. But of course he did nothing of the kind. Not even when the troubles began here in the Shire began to bite more and more deeply. When goblins started raiding the borders of the North Farthing and the Buckland had to be abandoned to the old forest. No, he started insisting to anyone who would listen that Middle-earth was doomed, that there was no hope left in elves or dying Numenor, that Sauron's final victory would surely come before, oh, I forget what the date was. It was some year or other, not too far from now. He spent hours reading through books of lore, making long lists of reasons why the Dark Lord's triumph was surely at hand. Why did he do that? Why, for the same reason that drove him to each of his other excuses in turn, to prove to himself that his decision to refuse the quest hadn't been the terrible mistake he knew perfectly well it had been. And then, of course, the ring betrayed him, as it betrayed Gollum and Isildur before him. He came home late at night, after drinking himself half under the table at the Ivy Bush, and discovered that the ring was nowhere to be found. After searching Bag End in the frantic state, he ran out the door and down the road toward Bywater, shouting, "My precious! My precious!" He was weeping and running blindly in the night, and when he got to the bridge, he stumbled, over he went into the water, and that was the end of him. They found his body in a weir downstream the next morning.
Whoa.
The worst of it is that right up to the end, right up to the hour the ring left him, he could still have embarked on the quest. It would have been a different journey, and quite possibly a harder one. With Rivendell gone, he would have had to go west rather than east, across the far downs to Cerdon and the Grey Havens, where you'll find most of the High Elves who still remain in Middle-earth. From there, with such companions as might have joined him, he would have had to go north and then eastward, through Arnor, past the ruins of, Misty Mountains, and then across one of the northern passes, a hard and risky journey, but by no means impossible. For with no more need to hinder travel between Rivendell and Lorien, the Dark Lord's watch on the mountains had grown slack. Beyond the mountains, the Wood Elves still dwell in the northern reaches of Mirkwood, along with refugees from Lorien and the last of the Beornings. He could have gotten shelter and help there, and boats to travel down the river running into the heart of Wilderland. From there, his way would have been led by foot by the poorly guarded northern borders of Mordor, when has Sorin ever had to face a threat from that quarter? So you see that it could have been done. It still could be done if someone were willing to do it. Even though so much of what could have been saved 30 years ago has been lost, even though Minas Tirith, Eldoris, Lorien, and Rivendell have fallen, and the line of the kings of Gondor is no more, it would still be worth doing. There would still be many things that could be saved. Nor would such a journey have to be made alone. Though Aragorn, son of Arthorn, was slain in the defense of Rivendell, there are still rangers to be found in Cirdan's realm and the old lands of Arnor. There are elf warriors who hope to avenge the bloodshed at Rivendell, and dwarves from the Blue Mountains who have their own ancient grudges against the Dark Lord. The last free Rohirrim retreated to Minerva after Elmorim fell at Helm's Deep and still war against King Grima, while Gondor west of the river, Gilraine, clings to the tenuous independence who would rise up against Sorin at need. Would those and the elves of Lindon been enough? No one can say. There are no certainties in this business except for the one Frodo chose, the certainty that doing nothing will guarantee Sorin's victory. And there might even still be a wizard to join such a quest. In fact, there would certainly be one, the very last of them, as far as I know. Gandalf perished when Lorien fell, I am sorry to say, and as for Sorin, Saruman, the last anyone saw of him, he was screaming in terror as two ringwraiths dragged him through the door of the Dark Tower. His double-dealing was never likely to bring him a good end. The chief of the ringwraiths rules the Isengard now. Still, there was the third in the western lands, fool and bird tamer, Saruman called him, having never quite managed to notice that knowledge of ways of nature and the friendship of birds and beasts might have considerable value in the last need of Middle-earth. Rangest is his name. Yes, that would be me. Why am I telling you all this? Well, you are old Frodo's youngest cousin, are you not? Very nearly the only one of his relatives, with enough of the wild Tookish blood in you to matter. Or so I'm told. It was just a month ago that you and two of your friends were walking in the woods, and you spoke with quite a bit of anger about how the older generation of hobbits had decided to huddle in their holes until the darkness falls. Those were your words, I believe, your very words. How do I know that? Why, a little bird told me, a wren to be precise, a very clever and helpful little fellow, who runs errands for me from time to time when I visit this part of Middle-earth. If you meant what you said, then, there is still hope. And the ring? No, it was not lost, or not for long. It slipped from its chain and fell from old Frodo's pocket as he stumbled home that last night, and a field mouse spotted it. I had briefed all the animals and birds around Hobbiton, of course, and so she knew what to do. She dragged the ring into the thick grass, and when dawn came, caught the attention of a jay, who took it and hid it high up in a tree. I had to trade quite a collection of sparkling things for it, but here it is, in this envelope, waiting for someone to take up the quest that Frodo refused. The choice is yours, dear Hobbit. What will you do?
Wow.
The last chapter in John Michael Greer's Collapse Now and Avoid the Rush, the Best of the Archdruid Report. The Time of the Seed Bearers. originally published on the 30th of April, 2014. Myths, according to the philosopher Sallust, are things that never happened but always are. With a few modifications, the same rule applies to the enduring narratives of every culture, the stories that find a new audience in every generation, as long as their parent cultures last. Stories of that stature don't need to chronicle events that actually took place to have something profoundly relevant to say. And the heroic quest I used last week to frame a satire on the embarrassingly unheroic behavior of many of industrial civilization's more privileged inmates is no exception to that rule. That's true of hero tales generally, of course. The Thegans and Corals who sat spellbound in an Anglo-Saxon mead hall while a Scop chanted the deeds of Beowulf to the sound of a six-stringed lyre don't have to face the prospect of wrestling with cannibalistic ogres or battling fire-breathing dragons, as we're doubtless aware, well aware of the facts, of that fact, and we're doubtless well aware of that fact. If they believed that terrible creatures of a kind no longer found once existed in the legendary past, why so do we? The difference in our case is merely that we call our monsters dinosaurs and insist that our paleontologist storytellers be prepared to show us the bones. The audience in the Mead Hall never wondered whether Beowulf was a historical figure in the same sense as their own great-grandparents. Since history and legend hadn't yet separated out in the thinking of the time, Beowulf and those great-grandparents occupied exactly the same status, that of people in the past about whom stories were told. Further than that, it was unnecessary to go, since what mattered to them about Beowulf was not whether he lived, but how he lived. The tale's original audience, it's worth recalling, got up the next morning to face the challenges of life in the Dark Age, Britain, in which defending their communities against savage violence was a commonplace event. Mm. Having the example of Beowulf's courage and loyalty in mind must have made that harsh reality a little easier to face. Mm. The same point can be made about the hero I borrowed and rewrote in last week's post, Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. Frodo Baggins was no Beowulf, which was, of course, exactly the point, since Tolkien was writing for a different audience in a different age. The experience of being wrenched out of a peaceful community and sent on a long march toward horror and death was one that Tolkien faced as a young man in the First World War, and watched his sons face in the Second. That's what gave Tolkien's tale its appeal. His hobbits were ordinary people facing extraordinary challenges, like so many people in the bitter years of the early 20th century. The contrast between Beowulf and The Lord of the Rings is precisely that that between the beginning and the zenith of a civilization. Beowulf, like his audience, was born in an age of chaos and violence, and there was never any question of what he was supposed to do about it. The only detail that had to be settled was how many of the horrors of his time he would overcome before one of them finally killed him. Mm. Frodo Baggins, like his audience, was born into a world that was mostly at peace, but found itself faced with a resurgence of a nightmare that everyone in his community thought had been laid to rest for good. In Frodo's case, the question of what he was going to do about the crisis of his age was what mattered most. And, of course, that's why I was able to stand Tolkien's narrative on its head last week by tracing out what would have happened if Frodo's answer had been different. Give it a few more centuries, and it's a safe bet that the stories that matter will be back on Beowulf's side of the equation. As the process of decline and fall now underway leads into an era of dissolution and rebirth that we might as well call by the time-honored label Dark Age. For the time being, though, most of us are still on Frodo's side of things, trying to come to terms with the appalling realization that the world we know is coming apart, and it's up to us to do something about it. That said, there's a crucial difference between the situation faced by Frodo Baggins and his friends in Middle Earth, and the situation faced by those of us who have awakened to the crisis of our time, here and now. Tolkien was a profoundly conservative thinker and writer, in the full sense of that word. The plot engine of his works of adult fiction, The Silmarillion, just as much as The Lord of the Rings, was always the struggle to hold on to the last scraps of a glorious past, and his powers of evil want to make Middle-earth modern, efficient, and up-to-date by annihilating the past and replacing it with a cutting-edge industrial landscape of slag heaps and smokestacks. It's thus no accident that Sauron's speech to Gandalf in Book 2, Chapter 2 of The Fellowship of the Ring is a parody of the modern rhetoric of progress. Or that The Return of the King ends with a Luddite revolt against Sharkey's attempted industrialization of the Shire. Tolkien was a keen and acerbic observer of 20th century England and wove much of his own political thought into his stories. The victory won by Tolkien's protagonists in The Lord of the Rings, accordingly, amounted to restoring Middle-earth as far as possible to the condition it was before the War of the Ring. With the clock turned back a bit further here and there, for example, the reestablishment of the monarchy in Gondor, and a keen sense of the loss surrounding those changes that couldn't be undone. That was a reasonable goal in Tolkien's imagined setting, and it's understandable that so many people want to achieve the same thing here and now, to preserve some semblance of industrial civilization in the teeth of the rising spiral of crises that are already beginning to tear it apart. I can sympathize with their desire. It's become fashionable in many circles to ignore the achievements of the industrial age and focus purely on its failures, or to fixate on the places where it fell short of the frankly utopian hopes that clustered around its rise. If the Enlightenment turned out to be far more of a mixed blessing than its more enthusiastic prophets like to imagine, and if so many achievements of science and technology turned into sources of immense misery once they were hoarded out in the service of greed and political power, the same can be said of most human things. Quote, if it has passed from the high and the beautiful to darkness and ruin. Tolkien commented of a not dissimilar trajectory, that of old the fate of ardor marred. And then he links that to The Silmarillion. Still, the window of opportunity through which modern industrial civilization might have been able to escape its unwelcome destiny has long since slammed shut. That's one of the things I meant to suggest in last week's post by sketching out a Middle-earth already ravaged by the Dark Lord, in which most of the heroes of Tolkien's trilogy were dead, and most of the things they fought to save had already been lost. Even with those challenges, though, Tolkien's narrative no longer fits the crisis of our age as well as it did a few decades back. Our Ring of Power was the fantasy glut of energy we got from fossil fuels. We could have renounced it as Tolkien's characters renounced the One Ring before we'd burnt enough to destabilize the climate and lock ourselves into a set of economic arrangements with no future. But that's not what happened, of course. We didn't make that collective choice when it still could have made a difference, when peak oil was still decades in the future. Anthropogenic climate change hadn't yet begun to destabilize the planet's ice sheets and weather patterns, and the variables that define the crisis of our age, depletion rates, CO2 concentrations, global population, and the rest of them, were a good deal less overwhelming than they've now become. As the limits to growth pointed out more than four decades ago, any effort to extract industrial civilization from the trap it made for itself had to get underway long before the jaws of that trap began to bite, because the rising economic burden inflicted by the ongoing depletion of non-renewable resources and the impacts of pollution and ecosystem degradation were eating away at the surplus wealth needed to meet the costs of the transition to sustainability. That prediction has now become our reality. Grandiose visions of vast renewable energy buildouts and geoengineering projects on a global scale of the kind being hawked so ebulliently these days by the prophets of eternal business as usual, fit awkwardly with the reality that a great many industrial nations can no longer afford to maintain basic infrastructures or to keep large and growing fractions of their population from sliding into desperate poverty. The choice that I discussed in last week's post, reduced to its hard economic bones, was whether we were going to put what remained of our stock of fossil fuels and other non-renewable resources into maintaining our current standard of living for a while longer, or whether we were going to put it into building a livable view, a livable world for our grandchildren. The great majority of us chose the first option, and insisting at the top of our lungs that, of course, we could have both, that we could have both, and that we could, and that, of course, we could have both, did nothing to keep the second from slipping away into the realm of might have beens. The political will to make the changes and accept the sacrifices that would have been required to do anything else went missing in action in the 1980s and hasn't been seen since. That's the trap that was hidden in the crisis of our age. While the costs of transition were still small enough that we could have met them without major sacrifice, the consequences of inaction were still far enough in the future that most people could pretend that they weren't there. By the time the consequences were hard to ignore, the costs of transition had become too great for most people to accept, and not too long after that, they had become too great to be met at all. As a commentary on our current situation, in other words, the story of the heroic quest has passed its pull day. As I noted years ago, insisting that the world must always follow a single narrative is a fertile source of misunderstanding and misery. Consider the popular insistence that the world can grow its way out of problems caused by growth, as though you could treat the consequences of chronic alcoholism by drinking even more heavily. What gives that frankly idiotic claim the appeal that it has draws on one of the standard stories of our age, the Horatio Alger story of the person who overcame long odds to make a success of himself. That does happen sometimes, which is why it's a popular story. The lie creeps in when the claim gets made that this is always what happens. When people insist, as so many of them do, that of course we'll overcome the limits to growth and every other obstacle to our allegedly preordained destiny out there among the stars, all that means is that they have a single story wedged into their imagination so tightly that mere reality can't shake it loose. The same thing's true of all the other credos I've discussed in recent posts, from they'll think of something, through it's all somebody else's fault, right on up to we're all going to be extinct soon anyway, so it doesn't matter anymore. Choose any thought stopper you'd like, and behind it lies a single story repeating itself monotonously over and over in the heads of those who can't imagine the world unfolding in any other way. The insistence that it's not too late, that there must still be time to keep industrial civilization from crashing into ruin if only we all come together to make one great effort, and that there's any reason to think that we can and will come together, is another example. The narrative behind that claim has a profound appeal to people nowadays, which is why stories that feature it again, Tolkien's trilogy comes to mind, are as popular as they are. It's deeply consoling to be told that there's still one last chance to escape the harsh future that's already taking shape around us. It seems almost cruel to point out that whether that belief appeals to our emotions has no bearing on whether or not it is true. The suggestion I've been making since this blog first began 8 years ago is that we're long past the point at which modern industrial civilization might still have been rescued from the consequences of its own mistakes. The suggestion that I've been making since this blog began 8 years ago is that we're long past the point at which modern industrial civilization might still have been rescued from the consequences of its own mistakes. If that's the case, it's no longer useful to put the very limited resources we have left into trying to stop the inevitable. And it's even less useful to wallow in wishful thinking about how splendid it would be if the few of us who recognize the predicament were to be joined by enough other people to make a difference. If anything of value is to get through the harsh decades and centuries ahead of us, if anything worth saving is to be rescued from the wreck of our civilization, there's plenty of work to do, and daydreaming about mass movements that aren't happening and grand projects we can no longer afford simply wastes what little time we have left. That's why I've tried to suggest in previous posts here that it's time to set aside some of the more familiar stories and try reframing the crisis of our age in less shop-worn ways. There are plenty of viable options. Plenty, that is, of narratives that talk about what happens when the last hope of rescue has gone whistling down the wind, and it's time to figure out what can be saved in the midst of disaster. But the one that keeps coming back to my mind is one I learned and ironically dismissed as uninteresting quite a few decades ago. In the early years of my esoteric studies, the old legend of the fall of Atlantis. It's probably necessary to note here that whether Atlantis existed as a historical reality is not the point. While it's interesting to speculate about whether human societies more advanced than current theory suggests might have flourished in the late Ice Age and then drowned beneath rising seas, those speculations are as irrelevant here as trying to fit Grendel and his mother into the family tree of hominid say, or discussing how plate tectonics could have produced the improbable mountain ranges of Middle Earth. Whatever else it might or might not have been, Atlantis is a story, one that has a potent presence in our collective imagination. Like Beowulf or The Lord of the Rings, the Atlantis story is about the confrontation with evil. But where Beowulf comes at the beginning of a civilization and Frodo Baggins marks its zenith, the Atlantis story illuminates its end. Mind you, the version of the story of Atlantis I learned, in common with most of the versions in circulation in occult schools in those days, had three details that you won't find in Plato's account, or in most of the rehashes that have been churned out by the rejected knowledge industry over the last century or so. First, according to that version, Atlantis didn't sink all at once. Rather, there were three inundations separated by long intervals. Second, the sinking of Atlantis wasn't a natural disaster. It was the direct result of the clueless actions of the Atlanteans, who brought destruction on themselves by their misuse of advanced technology. The third detail, though, is the one that matters here. According to the mimeographed lessons I studied back in the day, as it became clear that Atlantean technology had the potential to bring about terrifying blowback, the Atlanteans divided into two factions: the children of the Law of One, who took the warning seriously and tried to get the rest of Atlantean society to do so, and the servants of the Dark Face, who dismissed the whole issue. I don't know for a fact that these latter went around saying, "I'm sure the priests of the Sun Temple will think of something." Orillicum will always be with us. The Ice Age wasn't ended by an ice shortage and the like, but it seems likely. Those of my readers who haven't spent the last 40 years hiding at the bottom of the sea will know instantly which of these factions spoke for the majority and which was marginalized and derided as a bunch of doomers. According to the story, when the first inundation hit and a big chunk of Atlantis ended up permanently beneath the sea, the shock managed to convince a lot of Atlanteans that the children of the Law of One had a point, and for a while there was an organized effort to stop doing the things that were causing the blowback. As the immediate memories of the inundation faded, though, people convinced themselves that the flooding had just been one of those things. And went back to their old habits. When the second inundation followed and all of Atlantis sank but the two big islands of Ruta and Deta, though, The same pattern didn't repeat itself. The children of the Law of One were marginalized even further, and the servants of the Dark Face became even more of a majority, because nobody wanted to admit the role their actions had in causing the catastrophe. Again, those of my readers who have been paying attention for the last 40 years know this story inside and out. It's what happened next, though, that matters most. In the years between the second inundation and the third and last one, so the story goes, Atlantis was, for all practical purposes, a madhouse with inmates in charge. Everybody knew what was going to happen, but nobody wanted to deal with the implications of that knowledge, and the strain expressed itself in orgiastic excess, bizarre belief systems, and a rising spiral of political conflict ending in civil war. Anything you care to name, as long as it didn't address the fact that Atlantis was destroying itself and that nearly all of the Atlanteans were enthusiastic participants in the activities driving the destruction. That was when the children of the Law of One looked at one another and, so to speak, cashed out their accounts at the First National Bank of Atlantis, invested the proceeds in shipping, and sailed off to distant lands to become the sea bearers of a new age of the world. That's the story that speaks to me just now. Enough so that I've more than once considered writing a fantasy novel about the fall of Atlantis as a way of talking about the crisis of our age. Of course, that story doesn't speak to everyone, and the belief system that insists either that everything is fine or that nothing can be done anyway have no shortage of enthusiasts. If these belief systems turn out to be as delusional as they look, though, what then? The future that very few people are willing to consider or prepare for is the one that history shows us is the common destiny of every other failed civilization, the long, bitter, ragged road of decline and fall into a dark age from which future civilizations will eventually be born. If that's the future ahead of us, as I believe it is, the necessary preparations need to be made now. If the best achievements of our age are to be carried into the future, when the time of the sea bearers arrives.
What a way to end that book.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. And at the very end it says, an Archdruid report bibliography. The following books all derive core themes, and in some cases a fair amount of rough draft prose, from sequences of weekly Archdruid report posts. All are written by me, except the After Oil series, which are anthologies of science fiction short stories written by readers of the Archdruid Report. Star's Reach and Twilight's Last Gleaming are novels, and the rest are nonfiction. And the books are The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, The Ecotechnic Future, Envisioning a Post-Peak World, 2009. The first one was 2008. That was 2009. The Wealth of Nature, Economics as If Survival Mattered, 2011. We've read all three of those. The Blood of the Earth, An Essay on Magic and Peak Oil. We read all the blog posts, or whatever the posts, yeah. But we haven't read that book. Mm-hmm. Not the Future We Ordered, Peak Oil, Psychology, and the Myth of Progress, 2013. We sold that one, as well as the Ecotechnic Future, but we also read it. After Oil, Science Fiction Visions of a Post-Petroleum World, 2012. We started reading that, but we haven't finished. Green Wizardry, 2013. We read the year's worth of posts that went into that, right. Blog posts went into that, but we haven't read the book. Mm-hmm. Star's Reach, a Novel of the Deindustrial Future, 2014. We just started that.
Right.
Probably about.
But then we got the next
right, exactly.
fiction.
Right, right, right. I think we're probably about 40 pages into that, 50
yeah,
pages
we got
into
Twilight's
that.
Last Gleaming.
Right. Decline and Fall, The End of Empire and the Future of Democracy in 21st Century America, 2014. We've not only read that, but I've read it like three times. Twilight's Last Gleaming, 2014. That's the fictional version of Decline and Fall. They're just brilliant together. After Progress, Reason and Religion at the End of the Industrial Age, which I read Galley Form, and then blurbed, and it'll be coming out next month. And then after Royal II and after Royal III, the years of crisis and the years of renewal are both science fiction, you know, things written by readers, and they're both coming out this year, 2015. Mm. And then the only one that's that was actually not part of that we've read, that we sold, but that wasn't part of his blog series, is Apocalypse Not. Apocalypse Not, right? Oh, that's our Archdruid.